Call the meeting to order. Can we do a roll call, please?
Regent Carter. Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo.
Here.
Regent Dubrava.
Here.
Vice Chair Geddes.
Here.
Regent Hayes.
Here.
Regent Lieberman.
Here.
Regent McAdoo.
Here.
Regent McMichael.
Here.
Regent Moran. Chair Page.
Here.
Regent Perkins.
Here.
Regent Trachuk. You have a quorum.
Thank you. Good. Please stand for the national anthem by Miss Emily Smith, followed by the Pledge of Allegiance by Regent Trachuk.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? And the rocket that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the
States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands,
one nation, under God, indivisible,
with
liberty and
justice for all. I'd like to take a moment of silence for two-time UNLV Alumni Association President Patrick Smith, who passed away recently. Thank you. We'll go to item number one, introduction and campus updates, starting with President Patterson.
Thank you, Chair Page. So happy National Higher Education Day to everybody. Just so happens it's today. I don't know who made it up. So I'd like to introduce, first of all, Abby Peters is here as the Faculty Senate Chair. This will be, I think, your last meeting. We might have a special meeting or two in there, but I want to thank her for her work as Faculty Senate Chair. Serge Bailiff will be the incoming Faculty Senate Chair. And then sitting in for Nicole Opfer is Vice President of Student Council, Alexander Loom. So I'd like to welcome him here today. So have really historic graduation, our first graduation at the Orleans Arena. We pretty much filled the place. Thank you for all the regents that were there. Again, our largest graduating class of over 600 graduates, and our first graduating class in Deaf Studies. So it was a very powerful evening. I want to thank everyone that attended. We are continuing to expand our teachers' academies. We've now expanded to six high schools beginning this fall. We're going to continue to expand those efforts. We've added Foothill and Coronado High School. To go along with four other schools that are early identifying teachers in the high schools, providing dual credit opportunities, and encourage them to continue toward obtaining a teaching degree to help address the teacher shortage. Also wanted to note that we are well on the way to starting the first class in speech pathology masters. We have admitted a class of 25 full-time and 30 part-time students, so it's a pretty large class to start the master's program. We are awaiting the final word on accreditation, which we expect to happen within the next 30 days. So we're very excited about that. We receive now, this coming fall, 26 new, what's called Dream.us scholarships. Those are full scholarships, and that class has 100% retention. And it's really addressed towards students who are DACA students and undocumented, and it's been a terrific program for the college. And our thanks to Dream.org for funding those scholarships. So that's it for the highlights from Nevada State College. Thank you.
Thank you, President Patterson. President Hilgerson.
Okay, President Hilgerson, for the record. So first of all, introductions. I want to start by thanking outgoing Faculty Senate Chair Mike Holmes for a wonderful job last year. It was just a pleasure working with Mike and his leadership team. And I'd like to introduce to you incoming President or Chair of the Faculty Senate, Ann Flesher, Mathematics faculty member, and Yvonne Allen, and you know Yvonne very well, incoming Vice Chair of the Faculty Senate. I know they were here earlier today, so I think they're still around. I'd also like to welcome to our Student Government Association leadership team, Alexandra Patry, who will be the incoming SGA president. There she is. And Valeria Saborio, who will be the incoming vice president of the SGA. And I'm so excited to work with these two amazing women. Since the last board meeting, much has happened at TMCC. We had the 45th Annual Student Art and Design Exhibition, Skills USA Competition, the Northern Nevada Diversity Summit, and a visit to the Pennington Health Science Center from Senator Jackie Rosen. These are just a few of the highlights. Congratulations to the TMCC Graphic Communications Program for their success in supporting student work. TMCC students recently swept the student categories in the 2019 American Advertising Awards, or ADDIE, an award sponsored by the American Advertising Federation. And TMCC architecture student Anthony DeCola had the winning design of the future Charters of Freedom Monument that will eventually be constructed in downtown Reno. We also held another successful second annual Logistics Leadership Conference, an event designed to inspire and to network students with businesses serving the budding Northern Nevada logistics industry. Perhaps one of our most impressive achievements this past year is our apprenticeship numbers. The Nevada Apprenticeship Project, led by TMCC, assists employers to set up and manage registered apprenticeships for their employees. Our apprenticeship program launched in 2017 with one apprentice. By fall of 18, it has grown to 488 apprentices. 422 are TMCC students, serving 10 employers. In addition, we also articulate 437 students in union sponsors apprenticeships, and we appreciate this valuable partnership. So when you add those two together, you get over 900 apprentices in the past year at TMCC, and we're really proud of that work, and I'm very proud of Barbara Walden, Kyle Dalpe, Cheryl Olson, who unfortunately has left us, but they've done amazing work. Commencement, TMCC awarded 1,428 degrees and certificates to 1,120 students this year. Thank you so much, those of you Regents who attended our ceremony. It was such a pleasure, and it's just an honor, and we really appreciate those of you who travel long distances to get to the TMCC commencement. We're so glad that you could share that with us. We also gave 5 bachelor's degrees this year, and also 75 of the graduates that you shook hands with were veterans, so that's just really terrific. The last thing that I'll mention is that we recently updated our EMSI study, our economic study, which shares in a very sort of economist sort of way what Truckee Meadows Community Colleges gives back to the community in terms of dollars. And what we found was, and there's a kind of a detailed study, I'm just giving you a couple of highlights, that as an institution, we served 30,389 credit and non-credit students, that's in the last couple of years, and supported 7,531 jobs in 16 and 17. The overall impact of our presence in the local business community amounted to $484.9 million, almost $485 million in added income. This amount is equal to 2% of the GRP of Washoe County, which is pretty significant considering this is one organization. TMCC promotes economic growth in Washoe County in a variety of ways, adding $67.5 million of income to our local economy and creating 1,200 jobs. In fact, one in every 42 jobs in Washoe County is supported by the activities of TMCC and its students. So we're very pleased with the economic impact study. We will use this data to get more grants and to help educate the community as to the economic value of Truckee Meadows Community College in our region. So I'll close by saying fall planning is well underway. We're super excited about the sports field groundbreaking August 15th. Be there, be square, and we'll send you the invite. And we look forward, and I hope you could look forward to seeing you at that event. Thank you.
Thank you. President Miana.
Good afternoon, everyone. Joining me today are Professor Janice Mackay, Chair of the UNLV Faculty Senate, Stephanie Molina, President of the Graduate and Professional Student Association, and Hannah Patnaud, the new President of the Consolidated Students of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I want to take this moment to thank them for being the best partners a president could have, and I want to thank past faculty chair, Senate Chair Doug Unger, for what was a really an incredible effort in this past year. In terms of campus highlights, well, as 3,000-plus students walked across the stage at the Thomas and Mack this May, we could look back on another successful spring semester and a particularly momentous academic year. Thank you very much to the Chancellor and the Regents for joining us for that special day. 13 UNLV programs, including 8 from Boyd Law, ranked among the top 100 in U.S. News & World Report annual collection of top graduate and professional schools. Boyd ranked 58th overall, its highest ranking to date. Boyd also topped the nation in legal writing, and the Saltman Center for Conflict Resolution placed 5th in dispute resolution. This spring, we also launched the first MGM Policy Institute at UNLV Symposium, which was focused on growing and empowering the middle class, and it featured Harry Reid, John Boehner, and many other luminaries in the world of politics and policy. Later in the semester, we hosted a seminar on anti-Semitism, and then Al Gore graced us with a riveting presentation on climate change. Add to that our Barrack Lecture Series featuring Kamau Bell and Annie Leibovitz and the Black Mountain Institute's Believer Festival, and I think there's little question that UNLV really has become the intellectual and artistic nexus of Las Vegas. Our students also continue to be nationally recognized for their excellence. For the first time in nearly two decades, two UNLV students in a single cycle were recipients of the Goldwater Scholarship, the nation's premier undergraduate award in STEM fields, and they are among just 496 handpicked scholarship recipients. In April, UNLV's American Marketing Association student chapter topped hundreds of national and international teams at a collegiate conference. The team won the international case competition and the Sabre marketing simulation and was recognized as a top 10 collegiate chapter. UNLV School of Music undergraduate and graduate students won three prestigious 2019 Downbeat Magazine Student Music Awards this spring, and these are among the highest recognition in jazz education worldwide. UNLV student athletes are also setting new academic records, which is very important for us. Highlighted by football's best ever academic performance, five UNLV athletics programs set or tied their best NCAA academic progress rate single year score. Men's soccer also bested its previous multi-year high score, and volleyball tied its record with a perfect 1,000 multi-year score. In research news, political science professor Tiffany Howard received the prestigious Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellowship for the 1920 academic year. She will be working at the Paris-based United Nations organization UNESCO, advancing her research on digital terrorism and online radicalization. Additionally, astrophysicist Bing Zhang and an international team of astronomers discovered a new way to spot when collisions occur between two neutron stars in distant galaxies, and this will be published in the journal Nature. At the end of May, the International Conference on Gambling and Risk-Taking was hosted by UNLV's International Gaming Institute, and it brought together industry and academic leaders from across the world sharing ideas that are redefining gaming. A partnership between the College of Urban Affairs and the City of Las Vegas aims to improve community resilience. And this is a joint project that could impact Las Vegas and its people, institutions, businesses to ensure how the city survives, adapts, and grows. UNLV is also partnering with DRI and UNR on a summer robotics program for Nevada's K through 12 teachers, and the School of Nursing's Nurse Camp will also be offered next month for local high school students. Finally, the College of Education and Clark County School District recently announced Rebel Teach, a unique program that offers high school students the opportunity to earn dual credit in undergraduate teacher education courses while still in high school. Classes mirror the curriculum taught at UNLV with credits transferable to any NSHE institution upon graduation, obviously. So we continue to be committed to the excellence in teaching, research, and community engagement that will earn us top-tier status across the board, and we thank you very much for your support.
Thank you. President Hellens.
Good afternoon. Joyce Hellens, Great Basin College. I would like to thank Professor Gino Jung, who is the outgoing Faculty Senate Chair, for his excellent leadership this past year, and welcome Professor George Klebb as the incoming chair, and also congratulate Becky Linville, who will continue on in student leadership. Great Basin College finished a year of very healthy enrollments. Depending on the semester, we were up 12 to 15% in our FTE. And we had healthy completions, and so we awarded approximately 620 awards. We filled the Elko Convention Center, even though we had initiated other commencement activities across our geography. We had a commencement exercise in Pahrump, and first time in Winnemucca. Next year will also be Ely. In Winnemucca, we had about 250 chairs. We ended up having to put over 400, so it was very successful. And thank you to the regents who attended our multiple commencement exercises. We did cover a lot of miles in a short period of time. So it was a year of growth and of success across the enterprise. We successfully added technical programs at our branch campuses. We once again received number one in nursing education. And we graduated, as some of you had heard in previous, with the new Biological Sciences Baccalaureate. We graduated approximately 15 in both the AS and the BS. And four of our baccalaureate graduates are now studying for their MCAT, hoping to become physicians and come back and serve rural Nevada. So this pathway is also linked to one of our many collaborations with UNR. So we have, this just scratches the surface on accomplishments and success, and sometimes it's frustrating that these successes can be overshadowed by the funding reductions that we have. So I was thinking, how is it that we could put this pattern of excellence at Great Basin College in context? And what happened is the context is a new motto. Great Basin College is now, we're saying, represents the gold standard in the Silver State. And you will be hearing much more about that gold standard throughout next year and even during this meeting. So the gold standard in the Silver State represents our authentic commitment to student success. It also represents our dedication to continuous improvement, to finding out what we can do better and actually doing it. It's not settling, and we're also not saying it's perfection, because we realize this is an ongoing journey. We're not saying it's good enough. We want to always do better. And we want to consciously create exceptional student experiences every single day, whether online or face-to-face. So we will be applying this gold standard to everything we do, and you'll be hearing much more about it. Thank you.
Thank you. President Abbott.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Page. Kristen Abbott for the record. So first of all, I'd like to thank outgoing Chair of our Faculty Senate, Dr. Richard Disoni, for your leadership and for your partnership. It's been a pleasure working with you. And to welcome Dr. Amanda Keene-Ziebert, who's the incoming Chair-elect of our Faculty Senate at DRI. And thank you guys again very much. It's been a pleasure working with all of you. So first, our 60th anniversary. I'd like to start by thanking everyone on the board and all of our NSHE colleagues who attended our first series of events celebrating DRI's 60th anniversary. Over the last 3 months, we have welcomed visitors to our campuses in both Reno and Las Vegas, hosted donors, city leaders, and U.S. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto for an inspiring conversation on smart communities in Las Vegas at the Lou Ravo Center, and engaged with students, families, and stakeholders from across Nevada. I'm especially proud to share that our open house events in both Reno and Las Vegas attracted more than 1,500 people in each location, with families and students of all ages engaging with our faculty and exploring our laboratories and research facilities. I should mention that's the first time in a decade that our campus in Reno has actually been open to the public. Both events were linked to the larger science and technology festivals in both Reno and Las Vegas. And at DRI, we are proud to be one of the co-founders of the inaugural Northern Nevada Science and Technology Festival, which happened roughly a month ago. We even had one person to stop in at the check-in table and say thank you for opening the doors to DRI and inviting families to see all the incredible science at DRI. She said it was like when Willy Wonka opened the gates to the chocolate factory. So please stay tuned for more of our 60th anniversary event announcements, and including the announcement of our new Nevada medalist and the events that will take place likely in late November around the new Nevada medalist. Research highlights. So first, as I hope all of you have saw on the front page of the RGU Today last month and in this week's DRI newsletter, a new study published in Nature Communications from our Ice Core team provides new insight into how wildfires across the West are causing snow melt to occur earlier and faster. The bottom line, they found that snow melts an average of 5 days earlier after a wildfire across the western U.S. And in addition, the timing of snow melt will be accelerated for up to 15 years after that wildfire actually has happened. Another result. This is about the DRI Foundation. I'm excited to share that DRI has eight internal research teams that are hard at work on eight projects that were funded by the DRI Foundation's Innovation Research Program last fall. Just last week, we had a team of scientists sampling microplastics in Lake Tahoe. You can see all their work and watch a video of what they're doing on the DRI Instagram feed. I also wanted to take this opportunity to provide an update on our research success metrics at DRI. As the fiscal year comes to a close, we look at certain metrics related to proposal output and success. Our proposal submissions are up by 24% over last year. Furthermore, only 13% of our new proposal submissions since last January were for traditional federal agencies, indicating that our focus on diversifying our research revenue streams and going after competitive funding opportunities with foundations, the private sector, state and local agencies, and international groups is gaining traction. Some examples of successful research proposals in the last year: $250,000 to perform pioneering archaeological research using drones with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the Willamette Witt River Valley in Oregon. $500,000 from the National Science Foundation to understand how the increased presence of airborne bacteria, pollen, and viruses are impacting air quality in northern Nevada. $1.5 million from the National Institute of Health to study the human health effects of wildfire and prescribed burn smoke in northern Nevada. We're very proud and we're very excited to share those results as they emerge. Within DRI's new Office of Education, I'm proud to share that last week we launched the first of two new professional development programs for Nevada's K-12 teachers. This was together with our colleagues from UNLV, and President Miana already mentioned this particular enterprise. Facilitated by DRI's STEM Education Outreach Program, Science Alive, and funded through Tesla's K-12 Education Investment Fund, the all-new Robotics Academy of Nevada welcomed over 80 teachers to UNLV for a week of training and hands-on learning. We'll be hosting the second event here in Reno later this summer together with our colleagues from UNR. This collaborative program is designed to help Nevada's middle and high school teachers to coach robotics in the middle schools with mentoring support throughout the year. I'm also happy to share that our large population health research study, the Healthy Nevada Project, a partnership with Renown, has expanded to southern Nevada. This happened last month, and we're now offering no-cost genetic testing to 25,000 new participants who can sign up for this study. Together with Renown, Helix, and now the University Medical Center of Southern Nevada, this expansion to Las Vegas truly gives the Healthy Nevada Project a statewide impact and makes Nevada the only state in the entire United States to offer such a program. Finally, last but not least, I'm very excited about a new science communication enterprise from DR. It's a partnership with our local NPR station here in Reno, KUNR, and we've turned our popular Science Distilled evening public lecture series into a podcast. The first two podcasts have been posted, and you can find it on our Twitter feed, download from Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. DRI, we're really committed to continuing to make sure that our science is creating a better society here in Nevada and that it makes for a smarter community. Thank you.
Thank you. President Z.
Good afternoon, Federico Zaragoza. For the record, I too would want to welcome our new student government president, Daniel Gutierrez, who's in the audience, and Dr. Arnold Bell, our new faculty senate representative, and also thank Darren Dockstetter for his service at the CSN for the past year. I am pleased to report that CSN awarded 3,721 degrees and certificates in academic year 2019. The great news is that approximately a third of our graduates, or 1,300 students, participated in our 47th annual commencement ceremony. As a result, we have the largest commencement ceremony in our history. And I want to thank Chairman Page, Chancellor Riley, and the many regents that attended and helped make our commencement a memorable event for all of us, especially the CSN graduates and their families. A special note is that this year, 61 high school seniors participated in the CSN commencement ceremony, having earned both a high school diploma and an associate's degree. That's a 25% increase over last year and confirms that our three CSN high schools have begun their journey to transform into an early college system. We're diligently working with CCSD to continue to increase our early college and CTE dual enrollment capacity and programs to provide CCSD students with integrated pathways into CSN, universities, and the workforce. While there is much work ahead, we are preparing to wrap up the 2019 Nevada legislative session with the successful passage of the top three CSN legislative priorities, which include the expansion of the CSN Prison Education Program, the renewal of the Nevada Promise Scholarship Program, and our partnership with the Nevada State College to build a new health and science facility at the CSN Henderson campus. As you know, our proposed new facility will position CSN and Nevada State College as a unique entry partnership to address the critical demands for nursing and health professionals in Southern Nevada. On this note, I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the support and leadership provided by the board, the chancellor, and especially Michael Flores and our interim government affairs officer, Mariana Kewen, for their amazing work on behalf of CSN during the legislative session. Our 2019 Nevada Promise Program update includes recognition that 4,700 high school students started the process and almost 1,000 of them have completed their Promise requirements and are on track to become CSN students this fall. I would also like to report that the U.S. Department of Education has officially certified CSN to award financial aid to our three new bachelor's degree programs, Deaf Studies, Nursing, and Project Management. We're now proceeding with the recruitment phase to launch our programs as early as fall 2019. The CSN multi-campus migration has reached another successful milestone. We have extended offers to two candidates to fill the North Las Vegas and the Charleston campus vice president positions. The CSN multi-campus model will allow our students to have a common student experience at each of our campuses while allowing each campus to be more responsive to their respective service areas and stakeholders. On the workforce front, the CSN Division of Workforce and Economic Development, Workforce Connection, and Clark County were awarded the ACT Work Ready National Community designation for creating a pool of 2,000 students and job seekers that earned ACT WorkEase National Career Readiness certifications through CSN. The WorkEase certification certifies that students possess the critical foundational or soft skills required for entry-level employment. Work on our three student union construction projects are still proceeding on time and on budget and scheduled for fall 2019 grand opening. Mr. Chairman, if I could, I will conclude my report with the news that the CSN videography and film students received 19 Student Production Emmy Award nominations from the Pacific Southwest National Academy of Television and Arts and Sciences. This is more than any two- or four-year university chapter in the region. Our students have been nominated 73 times in the last 5 years, so we extend our congratulations to Program Director John Aliano and all of the nominated students. That constitutes my report.
Thank you. President Solares.
Thank you, Regent Page. Vince Solis, for the record, members of the board, thank you for having us out today. I would like to begin by thanking Mr. Jim Strange, Professor of Mathematics at WNC, for his service as Faculty Senate Chair. He is outgoing and incoming as Dr. Robert Morin. He is not able to be here today as he is teaching here at UNR today, but he is being represented by one of our senior faculty members, Mr. Jeff Down. I'd like to thank all three of them as campus leaders. They have been a great team to work with, and I'm glad that they're here today. I'd also like to introduce and take this time to introduce Dr. Kyle Dalpe, who is going to be joining the WNC team July 1st as our Vice President for Academic Affairs and Institutional Effectiveness. I saw Kyle here earlier. Kyle, there he is. Thank you for joining the team, Kyle. I also want to give a brief update to the Regents on our campus police consolidation. That is going extremely well. We have had multiple visits from the UNR officers in terms of leadership to campus, and now we have the presence there daily. We just had the K-9 units out there visiting with our daycare center and with the folks on campus. It's been a really great transition. And we are currently working on our Post Academy, which is a police officer's training course, and that will launch in the fall of 2020. That is being worked on by our academic leadership and the folks that are the representatives for campus police from UNR. I would like to also mention to the board that we have begun our work on closing the achievement gap for our African-American students. I want to thank Regents Perkins and McMichaels for joining us at that meeting. We have did a lot of brainstorming and a lot of strategizing about how to continue working with all of our minority students in different ways to close that achievement gap with those students. We'll be launching a new website in August. As that launches, we will send that out to the Regents for review, but it's new, it's slick, and it's really focus on how we manage our brand at WNC. We're also working with the funding that we received from the legislature on the prison education program. We are hoping to double the number of students that we serve in that program right now, which is 70, so we're hoping to get into the 140-150 range with the new funding that will be coming in. Our graduation, as many of the campuses have mentioned, has been one of our largest. I would like to thank all of the Regents that were able to attend. We had the governor and the attorney general as our guest speakers. In that graduation, we had 150 students from our JumpStart program. These are students in high school receiving their degrees in from WNC before they get their high school degrees. But we also had 46 students that were awarded degrees through either an automated awarding of degree because they already had the credits, or we reverse articulated the credits with UNR. So there was a mix of students in there, but that was a total of 46 students that received the degrees through a different process. Our nursing program has been recognized as number 2 in the state by pnccareers.org and number 3 in the state by registerednursing.org. We continue to work to improve that program and keep it at the forefront of some of the best nursing practices in the state. We just received a $200,000 contribution from one of our benefactors at the Pennington Foundation for Career Technical Education. We are launching in next month our new online advising program for students so we can continue to serve students in different capacities, along with our tech services for students so we can communicate with them more regularly. And we have also developed a mobile application for admissions to campus that will launch in August, and now you can use it on your phones and on your tablets. And I also wanted to thank members of ENCHI on the legislative team, Michael Flores, Kyle Dalpe, Luis from UNLV, Tony from CSN, Mariana from CSN, Tony from NSC, and Joy Holiday for all the work that they did down at the session. Thanks to the work in that area. The CIP funding for one of our facilities came in at the last minute, so I wanted to publicly thank them for all the work that they did. And I also wanted to recognize Michael Flores for helping us bring the governor and the attorney general to our graduation. And that is the report from WNC. Thank you so much.
Thank you. President Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Page. I'd like to begin by introducing our new ASUN student body president, Anthony Martinez. He's right here. He also served as speaker of the ASUN Senate last year, so we know him very well, and he's very effective. Tamara Gwynn will continue as the Graduate Student Association president. She's sitting at my right, and you heard her make presentations at our commencement events. I'd also like to thank Tarina Caserto very much for serving very effectively as Faculty Senate Chair for the last year. And we appreciate Dr. Brian Frost from Chemistry coming in to serve as Faculty Senate Chair next year. And he's right back here. He's a great teacher, too. I'd like to call your attention to a book that you all received. And it's really in the heart of what you all have been selecting as the principal goals for higher education. And the idea is that this is access for all. And it's a compendium of papers written by individuals primarily on our campus who have focused on access for students to the University of Nevada, Reno. You'll notice that it was edited first by Melissa Cherozzi. You know her as the woman in the great hats who organizes all of our commencement activities. And secondly, Theo Meek, who you will be hearing from talking about the co-requisite program. So take a look at these articles, and they really address the whole issue of access to college and some of the programs and some of the data about the effectiveness of these programs to enhance access to college. Secondly, I would like to note that UNR desires to work with Nevada's indigenous population. Our staff has met several times with and involved representatives of Nevada's indigenous people and agreed on an appropriate statement to recognize our indigenous people. And I'll read the statement that you will hear frequently as we begin meetings. And I quote, "As we commence this meeting in Reno, Nevada, we acknowledge that the University of Nevada, Reno is situated on the traditional homelands of the Numa, Northern Paiute, Washoe, Nuwa, the Western Shoshone, and the Nuwavi, the Southern Paiute peoples. These lands continue to be a gathering place for indigenous peoples, and we recognize their deep connections to these places," unquote. Now, after this last legislative season, I feel compelled to talk about the research mission of the Nevada System of Higher Education. When I was speaking before the money committees in the legislature, I reported that research is an important partnership between the state and the university. The state and the university support positions in research and the laboratories and the buildings, and the people that we hire into these positions bring the creative ideas, and they compete for operating resources to address the important issues of the day. So I'll give just a few examples of these individuals and how successful they've been in bringing their own operating resources to address very important issues of today. The leading cause of death in the United States, as you all know, is cardiovascular disease. And that caused us to create the Interdisciplinary Research Center being developed at the University of Nevada, Reno, supported by an $11 million five-year grant awarded by the Centers for Biomedical Research Excellence, and you know these as COBRA grants. This highly competitive program of the National Institutes of Health, the research center is focused on better understanding the molecular and cellular signals that regulate the cardiovascular system. Dr. Scott Early of our pharmacology department was awarded 5 NIH research project grants, along with this COBRA grant, totaling $22.6 million in highly competitive grants to focus on cardiovascular disease and the important signals that make the heart run. Additionally, Dr. Norman LeBlanc, also from pharmacology, Robert Harvey, and Dr. Yumei Feng also are involved and have been very competitive in bringing NIH grants for this general area of research. The COBRA grant also supports other scientists by contributing to 2 research cores. One of these is a transgenic mouse genotyping and phenotyping core, directed by Dr. Feng. and our high spatial and temporal resolution imaging center directed by Dr. LeBlanc. Important to note, without this kind of basic research, we don't develop the basic knowledge upon which applied research and clinical research occurs, which actually results in cures. That's why it's so important that the research missions be carried on at your research institutions. I'll give a few more examples very briefly. Two come from the College of Engineering, in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering. Two of these individuals have been awarded early career awards by the National Science Foundation, Dr. Matteo Arelli and Dr. Mohammed Ben Idris. They're both assistant professors, one in mechanical engineering and the second in electrical and biomedical engineering. These career awards are highly competitive, and they are given by the NSF to individuals who are not only promising scientists, but have the capacity to serve as young leaders of other scientists, graduate students, and postdocs in creating more scientific capacity in the nation. Dr. Ben Idris works to improve the resilience of cyber-physical energy systems against failure, both from physical failure and cyber attacks. Dr. Matteo Arelli's research seeks to create bio-inspired underwater robots equipped with actively morphing fins to achieve optimal energy advantages for underwater resource prospecting and mapping, along with surveillance and stealth operations for defense. And a final individual is Saeed Saidi. Dr. Saidi has pioneered, and this is a really interesting story, if you can even imagine what I'm about to tell you. Dr. Saidi has pioneered and revolutionized bridge construction, specifically with the use of innovative materials to not only make bridges safer, but to make them usable after a major earthquake. For this, the civil engineering professor in the College of Engineering has been honored by the American Society of Civil Engineering for his work with the Washington State Department of Transportation in the design, specification, preparation, and implementation of his technology as part of their State Route 99 off-ramp bridge in Seattle, Washington. The technology, using shape memory alloy materials of nickel titanium and custom composites concrete, allows the bridge columns to bend with an earthquake and then return to the original position. It's the first time this technology has ever been applied anywhere in the world. Now I'd like to introduce one student and one faculty member for brief presentations. I'll start with our student, Hector Arceniega is a first-generation PhD student working in UNR's Memory and Brain Laboratory, where the focus of his research is the behavioral and neural mechanisms of working memory in older adults and victims of traumatic brain injury. Also very useful work. He shares his love of the brain in outreach to schools and juvenile detention centers, providing an example of an academic research career and how this is possible. Hector, please.
Okay. Thank you for having me here today. I hope my slides come up briefly. Well, before, I want to thank the Regents for awarding me the 2019 Regents Scholar Award. Today I'll be talking to you guys about my research and my life, briefly in 5 minutes. But, all that in 5 minutes. But I want to begin by saying that I am a product of the Nevada school system, the public school system here. I am from Las Vegas, and I went to all these different schools that you see on, now you see on the board here. And I want to thank you for for investing in my education and continuing to invest in the minds of Nevada, as Milton Glickman said. As an undergraduate student, I slowly found out that I wanted to do a PhD. But what I wanted to do my PhD in was not clear. So I dove into research, of course. So as an undergraduate student, I worked in Ann Leonard's Ecology, Evolution, and Conservation Biology Lab, teaching bees how to forage from specific colored flowers. Not an easy task, let me tell you. I also worked in Dr. Marion Berryhill's Memory and Brain Lab as an undergraduate student in the Department of Psychology. Here, I was looking to see what are the neural underpinnings of working memory. My work in Dr. Berryhill's lab led me to two peer-reviewed publications, as you see down here. 5 years later, so I did 5 years of undergrad, I completed my undergraduate degree with a bachelor's in neuroscience, minor in certificate in gerontology, and minor in psychology in 2015. And I was the first. I am the first in my family to receive a college degree. So where am I now? So currently, I am a doctoral candidate in the Integrative Neuroscience Program in the Department of Psychology, and I stayed working with Dr. Marion Berryhill. I have two lines of research, one that focuses on improving working memory performance in older adults using neural stimulation, and the other one is looking at the effects of concussions on executive function. So since I have 5 minutes, I'm talking to you guys about one, and I chose to briefly discuss my research on concussions since it's also what my dissertation work is on. So this research first started in identifying, is there a deficit in people who've experienced these types of injuries? Now, you may think that these are people who are only athletes, but in Northern Nevada, skiing and snowboarding is really popular. And wearing your helmet is even more popular. Not wearing a helmet is even more popular for some reason. But in order to assess this question, is there visual working memory impairments in people who've had mild traumatic brain injuries or concussions, I decided to adopt a classic working memory task that's known as a change detection task. You're cued to a specific side. You're asked to remember things that show up on that specific side. You're shown either one, two, or three colored squares. They disappear. One comes back. Is it old or new? I've included a short video so you can see how difficult this task really is. So it goes really fast. So what the behavioral data tells us is that when participants are asked to remember three items for less than 1 second, we find that our control participants who have never reported a brain injury, or a head injury, sorry, outperform people who have had at least one concussion at any point in their lives, on average, 5 years after injury. So you may be saying, well, is this just this group of people? But we have been able to replicate this five different times now, using the same task and extending it to see what is the damage that is caused in visual working memory. So, quick overview, wear a helmet. If you decide to let your kids play sports, make sure you choose the right sport. And it's not, chess is a good one, bowling, yeah, non-injury indicated. And lastly, I want to thank everyone who has contributed to my career, specifically my grad advisor, Dr. Marion Berryhill, and the Department of Psychology, and now the Institute for Neuroscience. Any questions?
Thank you so much. Well done.
Thank you, Hector. So you see, immediately the results of research gives you great advice on what to avoid to protect yourself. For our faculty presentation today, I'd like to reintroduce you to Dr. James Kenyon. Dr. Kenyon used to be the Associate Dean of the School of Medicine for Research, and he stepped back a bit, but he didn't step back very far because Jim is now... has been elected by the neuroscience faculty to serve as the director of the new Institute for Neuroscience, which was board-approved and inaugurated in 2018 to support and sustain neuroscience programs and initiatives at the University of Nevada, Reno. Over the last 10 years, these neuroscience programs in research and education have grown tremendously, and this new institute is going to keep us organized and propelled forward in neurosciences. I invite Dr. Kenyon to the microphone.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Dr. Johnson, for this opportunity to talk to the group. On Tuesday afternoon, actually, I will be meeting with the INBRAE summer research undergraduates, including the FLAIR students. So we have a weekly meeting on responsible conduct of research. And I assign the students next time to give elevator pitches about their research that they'll be doing over the summer. And I said I would begin that by giving my elevator speech. And I appreciate the opportunity to practice that talk here in the next couple of minutes. And so my catch is, based on the introduction, on my way here, we received an email from the Office of Sponsored Projects that UNR may soon not be qualified to participate in the NIH R15 program. R15 grants are research grants. They are awarded to institutions with relatively low NIH funding. They provide research support and, importantly, undergraduate research support. The good news is UNR will not be eligible because our faculty have been sufficiently successful that we've crossed the threshold and may no longer be able to get these proposals. The bad news is our faculty have used them and our undergraduates have benefited from them terrifically because a key part of the R15 program is the undergraduate research project. The research will not go forward if it does not engage inappropriately with undergraduates. So the bad news is this is an opportunity that we may not have in the future. So, which leads me into the Institute for Neuroscience, and what we've been working on, and in a couple of slides I'll show you, is what are programs we can get into to fill in this hole that may come up soon. So I will skip over the part about me and go immediately now into the Institute for Neuroscience. It was approved, as you know, about a year ago by the Board of Regents, and the words here don't really give a sense of the scope of that. And the issue is neuroscience is a huge research enterprise across campus. It's in many colleges, many departments. It's spread all over. We have a lot of funding for it, but what UNR we felt really needed was an organizing umbrella, an organizational entity that could bring together all of this neuroscience, leverage it to the maximum possibility. And so the Institute was created. We have generous funding through the Office of Research and Innovation, and I thank Dr. Gautam for that. And last October, the neuroscientists in the group asked me if I would take on to be the director of this, and I've taken that on. So exactly what is it? And it's an interesting new experience for me. In some ways, it's like a department. We have 400 bachelors of science, and I apologize for the typographical error on this. There are 400 majors on campus that don't have a departmental home. Their faculty are faculty typically in biology and psychology. And so the Institute would like to be an academic home for these students, provide mentoring to link them to advising, and there is a dedicated advisor in the UNR advisory program, to direct them into research programs and to enable them, as Hector talked to you about, take the research out into the community. So we need to do this. It's an interesting challenge for me from the medical school because it's actually the psychology departments, the engineering schools, the biology departments have authority and responsibility for the faculty that the Institute will need to work with them. We also have what I call a public relations task for neuroscience. And I want to acknowledge the Desert Research Institute. The neuroscientists were very keen to take their science out into the public and through this program with the Discovery Museum and sponsored by the DRI. Several of our researchers have participated in this. Gideon Kaplowitz was talking about his really interesting research with octopus brains, and these will be included in the podcasts coming out with this. Brain Awareness Week is an opportunity for our undergraduates to take their neuroscience out into the community. Of course, research is an important part of this, and the Institute is very interested in leveraging the resources we've got for building partnerships, bringing things together to facilitate and develop research. So as I sat down and thought, what is it I should really do, what would be deliverable that the Institute could take on and, quite frankly, be a return on Dr. Gautam's investment for that, what is it we would be really well positioned to do? And I overshot with the slide. I apologize that I got a little overexcited. The Institute is, I think, very well positioned to do something relatively new here at the university, and I think it's very important. Our faculty, as I just mentioned, are very, very good at getting research grants. And a research grant funds the research directly and indirectly provides undergraduate research experiences by having an active lab. What we need to do and what the Institute is very interested in developing now are proposals for training grants. Training grants turn that exact relationship around. They support undergraduates and graduate students directly and research indirectly. So we're investigating a variety of programs that will be new to UNR, new to the state of Nevada, and new, frankly, to our region to provide training support for largely undergraduates, particularly undergraduates from underrepresented groups, and graduate students moving forward. We've got some very interesting ideas to bring students from, example, TMCC onto campus during the academic year, and to build on the INBRE project, which brings students from across Nevada in for summer research. So there are a variety of flavors for these kinds of things. There are a lot of acronyms here that I don't expect you to remember. Some of these programs are for undergraduate programs. The MARC program collaborates with the McNair program to facilitate and help minority undergraduate students into research. And again, literally is putting money into their pockets so they don't need to flip burgers, but can support themselves and get into research program. IMSD is a similar program for graduate students. The NINDS program that's in the middle there is a very interesting program, and Dr. Marion Weirich is coming to our Department of Psychology. She will be taking the Mikawa Chair for Clinical Psychology. She's directed a program based on this at Hunter College and has some very interesting ideas. Hope to work with her to develop recruiting and training for underrepresented students. The very bottom is actually where I've set my goal for hopefully the next couple of months and into the next year. NIGMS stands for the National Institute of General Medical Sciences. This is an institute that has no particular disease. Heart, lung, and blood is obviously interested in cardiovascular disease. Institute of Digestive Diseases have theirs. General Medical Science is a very broad institute and is particularly interested in training the next generation of biomedical sciences. 2 years ago, they revamped their so-called T32 program. T32 stands for training grant to fund and develop innovative evidence-based training for graduate students. And they created a program you see here called Transdisciplinary Basic Biomedical Sciences. This is brand new. In order to apply to this program, one must be at an institute that does not have a currently active training grant. There's not an active training grant actually in Nevada, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, or Alaska, it turns out. I'm looking at perhaps a UNR being a regional hub for this kind of activity. It's institutional support for a number of biomedical graduate PhD students. We do on campus everything that we need to do to obtain one of these programs. We need to organize it a little bit better, pay a little bit more attention to some of our recruiting and detail some of our training and responsible conduct of research, experimental rigor and transparency, things that the NIH very much wants to do. So I'm working very hard with David Zay in our graduate school, getting terrific support. An application for this program needs a ton of background data. Where have your applications come from for the last 5 years? What were the grade point averages? What are their GRE scores? What are their makeups in terms of race and ethnic background? A lot of support also from the Office of the Vice President from Research. We need a lot of data about what our research activities on campus so that we can document that we can actually get this program going. So my clincher for this is a map of training grants in cellular, molecular, and molecular sciences, and the Institute for Neuroscience wants to push this forward and put one of these little stars in the corner of Nevada. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
See no questions. Thank you so much, Doctor. Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, we're going to go to item number 3, public comment in Elko.
No public comment from Elko.
Thank you. Public comment in Las Vegas. If you could please state your name and spell it for the record. Hold on a minute, we can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
My name's Anthony Gebbia. The last name is spelled G-E-B-B-I-A. I'm the International Baccalaureate Program Coordinator at Spring Valley High School in Las Vegas. I'm here today to speak in support of the policy initiative to create a standardized policy for granting credit across Nevada for international baccalaureate exams. I've been an IB coordinator in Las Vegas for coming up on 25 years and an IB educator. The conversation about creating a standardized credit granting policy in Nevada has been going on about as long as I've been involved, with various progress that would generally stall. At that time, there was a single IB magnet program in Las Vegas at Valley High School, and only 2 IB programs in high schools anywhere in Las Vegas. Today, the program is, I believe, in 22 schools in Nevada. We started our program 4 years ago at Spring Valley, and in the fall, we'll welcome 575 IB students total in our program. So the demand for the program is clearly there. But what's more notable to that, to me, is that Clark County School District schools and Reno schools have been producing IB graduates for 40 years this year. The first IB school opened here in 1979. So in that 40 years, graduates from IB programs have a tough decision to make. These are the best of the best students, students who have chosen to challenge themselves at a level not offered and in Nevada, and they typically go elsewhere to attend college because they get more credit for the work they've done. We want our students to have options to challenge themselves, but we want those options to pay off for them in an obvious way. So we hope this policy goes forward and that you adopt it. Thank you so much for hearing me.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Tam Larnard, L-A-R. N-E-R-D. I'm the very proud principal, or in the international baccalaureate world, we say head of school of Spring Valley High School, which is right now currently the largest international baccalaureate high school, public high school in the state of Nevada, and very soon in the western United States. Our goal is to have, at full implementation of our IB programs, close to 700 IB magnet students attending Spring Valley High School in Las Vegas. We're also the only AVID, which is Advancement Via Individual Determination High School, provides a tremendous amount of support for our college-bound students, which clearly our international baccalaureate students are. The two programs have woven themselves together in great synchrony at Spring Valley High School. Many, many of our students advance and matriculate from Spring Valley to higher education, and most of them stay right here in the state of Nevada. I strongly encourage you to support this IB credit granting proposal. I think it'll benefit not only our students at Spring Valley, but all of the international baccalaureate students throughout the state of Nevada. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Okay, seeing no other public comment in Las Vegas, we'll go to public comment in Reno.
Greetings. I am Cheryl Cardoza, C-A-R-D-O-Z-A, Chair of the English Department at TMCC. I come today to speak about the proposed handbook revisions being considered as item 11. The English Department's faculty members like the idea of a co-requisite that gets students through English 101 in their first semester at TMCC, and is, in fact, piloting one starting this fall. However, the proposed policy includes serious issues that need to be addressed. First, the research done on the viability of the co-requisite model compares apples to oranges in a number of instances. It lumps developmental efforts in English in with those in math. The success rate of English developmental courses at TMCC between 2013 and 2017 averaged at 70%. We are currently experimenting with a new model of getting our students to college level, integrated reading, writing, and inquiry. This pilot has only had 1 year to prove its worth, and data is currently being analyzed. Two, it compares success rates in Tennessee, which measures success at a D minus, with success rates in Nevada, which uses C or C minus as the indicator of success. I also wondered why no one has researched the Community College of Baltimore County, which is a leader in the development of the co-requisite model. Three, it lumps community colleges in with the universities and the state college. Our students face different challenges and require creative options. One size cannot fit all. Secondly, only one possible model is being proposed, despite the fact that other successful models exist. The integrated reading and writing model is offered at both the Community College of Denver, CCR 092, and the Community College of Baltimore County, ACLT 053, as standalone courses alongside their co-requisite models. I recommend that the community college in this state be permitted to run parallel options in the same way that other institutions offer them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, R.A. Drew, that's D as in David, R-E-W. I came to speak to you today about the co-requisite proposal, agenda item 11. When I began making inquiries, and she sent me two documents which I carefully reviewed. Full disclosure, my interest is as an individual of the African diasporic community. Pursuing my personal interest, I was guided to a publication titled, quote, The Death of Imhotep, unquote. I started in the College of Southern Nevada regarding mathematics education. I started at Math 93. It took me years to progress to calculus, which was the first mathematics on my degree sheet. Depending on who you ask, Imhotep is a product of Hollywood, a historical figure, the architect of the pyramids of Egypt, a god, and a link to the African diasporic community's STEM legacy. Physician, astronomer, engineer, mathematician. I was inspired by the publication's invoking of Imhotep by the notion that the African diasporic community has a STEM legacy and entitlement. I did not see the proposed changes in item 11 as, quote, just in time, unquote, interventions. Instead, what I see is a further erosion of the African diasporic's STEM legacy, an erosion that begins at preschool age, moves K through 12, and continues in higher education. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Serge Balif, S-E-R-G-E-B-A-L-L-I-F. I'm here on behalf of the Nevada State College, speaking both as a math faculty and as an incoming faculty senate chair. I want to also speak about the co-requisite policy, agenda item number 11, and mostly I just want to express my gratitude to the regents for extending the implementation date for a couple of years. I believe that was the wisest thing that we could do. The success of this initiative is going to depend upon so much work and effort and collaboration, and by extending that date 2 years, I think you've done so much to move us forward in the right direction. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Seeing no other public comment, we're going to close public comment, and we're going to go to item number four, Regents Welcome, Introductions and Reports. Okay, seeing none, we will go to item number five, Chair of the Nevada Student Alliance Report.
Good afternoon. For the record, Tamara Gwynn, University of Nevada, Reno. On behalf of the Nevada Student Alliance, I would like to say thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. This morning, Nevada Student Alliance held our election of officers. At this meeting, we elected Nicola Opfer from Nevada State College as the chair of NSA, Anthony Martinez from the University of Nevada, Reno, as the vice chair of NSA, and Tamara Gwynn, myself, from the University of Nevada, Reno, as secretary for the 2019-2020 academic year. This year, the Nevada Student Alliance will be collectively working together to ensure that we are making decisions that are the most beneficial for our students. As student body leaders representing students across Nevada, we aim to ensure our constituents have a voice. We know our students have many concerns they would like to have addressed, and we look forward to collaborating across institutions to resolve some of these concerns. We hope to have a busy and successful year. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Item number 6, Chair of the Faculty Senate Chair's Report.
Doug Unger, Chair of Council of Faculty Senate Chairs, Nevada System of Higher Education, for the record. Our Senate Chairs began this academic year by thanking the Board of Regents for what you do. Now, at the close of a legislative session in which our elected leaders have not expressed nearly enough respect nor acknowledged your vital public service, on the contrary, have moved to change a system whose independence has proved its worth for a century and a half, we wish to express more emphatically our gratitude to each one of you. Also to thank the leaders and staff of NSHE for more work than our politicians and fellow citizens know. We need to tell them. We must raise our voices more loudly and clearly. Thanks especially to those on the board and in this room who have spoken out, who have defended our system and stood up for our legitimate needs. Thank you for putting yourself through that stiff, formal testimony before legislative committees that can at times feel more like a trial straight out of Franz Kafka than any rational process, as though higher education is being accused of a nebulous crime no one has ever told us about, nor can they say what it is. The 80th Nevada legislature proved progressive in so many ways: gun control, women's rights, criminal justice reforms, programs for the needy, the minimum wage, and more. It's baffling to us how higher education remained excluded from such progressive agendas. Something's missing in how we present ourselves. We need self-examination with a depth and sincerity of a Mencius. Let's also reconsider how to use our collective political power. 100,000-plus registered students, nearly 7,000 faculty and 3,000 staff, almost all eligible to vote. And each one of you distinguished regents represents more citizens in your large districts than any single legislator in our state. All this must mean something if we can only improve and refine our message. Our university and college system is one of the great progressive ideas in this state, not only for the wellspring of opportunity we provide our students, but every dollar invested impacts out more than sevenfold over the long term, contributing billions to the economy. Still, this 80th session, many of our politicians gazed out at us suspiciously from their thrones. We never thought we'd see smart people speak derisively of research, then cut its funding. Of the chancellor's connecting circles of system goals, access, success, achievement, workforce, research forms the base. How ironic that in the very year our two flagship universities passed the coveted milestone of R1 research highest status, our elected officials deliberately cut our research mission, $25 million by our rough count, as though resentful of our achievements. We welcome their support for student scholarships and aid, new construction at CSN and NSC, solid budgets for community colleges, that last-minute assignment of funds for a new engineering building at UNLV, these capital projects. Still, our state leaders have turned their backs on faculty, the vital human capital on which higher education most depends. I don't think they once seriously considered the stagnant salaries or salary compression eroding away at the current and future effectiveness of our schools. At least we did see amended out the language in appropriations unique to Nevada that prohibits state funding for performance or merit, that much at least. Then came the shocking surprise from the governor's finance office, the $6.4 million error in assigning an already inadequate 3% COLA. This must be corrected, and I appreciate the regents and the system's willingness to work with us to correct this shortfall. But when we say this must be corrected, what we mean is we must work with the state to make sure that this does not happen again. Because if it does happen again, they've changed the rules on us, and they will force us to pay for cost of living wages out of the pockets of our students, which is something that we resolved to them we would not do out of the increases in tuition. We must let the legislature and the governor's office know that they're forcing us into doing something we never wanted to do or desired to do in the first place. And it's not about the money. It's the injustice of that treatment, a demoralizing thumb in the eye, a defining of Nevada's faculty as second-class state employees. Or it's something worse than that, an attitude of an autocratic state that says, promise them anything, they'll take what they can get. How did this happen? It could be that a mark of maturity for our system is that we face this attitude. We've been around a long time. We were new in the 90s. We were building. We were the hot thing for the legislators and our politicians and citizens to support. We've been around a while, and familiarity can breed contempt, as the saying goes, and so can middle age. We reach for comfort in our students, who sum our count and make our old excuse, as Shakespeare said, the reason why we're here. Because of them, we still have the best and most rewarding jobs in the world. So enough of disappointments. What we mean to say is this. The way certain state leaders do not appreciate you and all in this room, we, the Faculty Senate chairs, appreciate you all the more. This next year, we'll need to come together to work on a whole list of issues. The new, very capable Senate chairs, the NC staff, and this distinguished board. I suggest we reconsider how and where to find additional resources to support the research missions of UNLV and UNR, even if it means going all the way to China to find them, and an intensified effort to knock on the doors of our business community and state leaders in a coordinated campaign. We will continue to collaborate with policies to achieve the systems and our institutional goals, and to work with faculty governments to motivate our colleagues to do what's needed to raise graduation rates and improve student success. Speaking to item 11 on today's agenda, we will work to implement the new prerequisite policy. We may request a few revisions better to shape it to the different needs of our schools and the distinct characters of our students, and maybe some time to engage faculty so we can be sure it will succeed, but we are on board with the Chancellor's policy. We ask ENSHE for help with some of this, some of the work that we must do with our internal administrations. For example, perhaps to give a bit more to break the logjam of collective bargaining at CSN and to assure all goes smoothly with forthcoming negotiations at other schools. And we hope to see a salary task force approved by the board next September that will combine faculty, system staff, and experts who will suggest models for compensation to resolve faculty salary issues that are acute and pressing, to help remedy that glaring omission of our state's political process with regard to higher education, which is unsustainable for a system that aspires to excellence. There's a lot to do. Our very capable incoming Senate chairs stand ready. Thank you to my fellow Senate chairs this year, to Tarina, Abby, Janet, Mike, Darren, Jim, Richard, and Jin. They are talented stewards who have done complex, difficult jobs, for which we should all be grateful, and they have improved our governance cultures. We've achieved a great deal together, not least a more reliable continuity for our changing leadership. I can't thank my colleagues enough. Also, that they trusted me to represent our group to this board, to the NG system, and to our state. Personally, I'll be pleased to return to teaching and creative activity, and to just being there more for my talented graduate students. I most look forward to that special moment that happens in a class that's like something performative, a sense I hope never to lose, how learning is not only as prescriptive and practical as our charts, graphs, and assessment data might lead us to believe, it's much more. Also, how we learn to live our lives. That mystery shared among students and teachers that writers often use metaphors of light to describe. For me, it's like a great live music, a magic in the air that never, ever happens quite the same way twice. I love that moment. I love the students in their seats. I also love the seats themselves. After they've filed out and I'm packing up, I stand there a moment every time, amazed to be a part of it, of the classroom, of the building that surrounds us, of the inspiring voices echoing across the campus lawns, and through the beauty of these solid structures, both concrete and of the mind, that we've spent our careers helping to build. I love the permanence in it, the enduring concept of what we do, the giving of ourselves over to something that lasts. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate that. We'll go to item number 7, Chancellor's Report. Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chair Page. I too want to thank everybody who worked tirelessly on the legislative session, our team led by Mike Flores, Kyle Doppy, and Joy Holliday, all the legislative reps from each of our institutions. The presidents did just a phenomenal job in working together. The cabinet who worked tirelessly, Chair Page and Vice Chair Geddes, who met with us weekly to discuss legislative issues. The Faculty Senate, Doug, you and your folks, the student leaders, Kent Irvine from the NFA. I think we all worked together well and really appreciate all the effort that everybody put into the legislative session. Two other things very briefly. Last week, Regents, I let you know that we made a trip down to Arizona State University, some of the presidents and provosts, to kind of look at best practices. As you know, ASU has done a pretty phenomenal job in moving student success to the top of the forefront of their thinking. Graduation rates have soared. They've closed the achievement gap. And we would like to report back in July, perhaps, kind of what our thoughts on them, on possible partnerships around very specific issues that I think will be very fruitful in those discussions. And the last thing I'd like to mention, too, is we've been obviously going through president's evaluations, and we've been having conversations with the presidents about, you know, potentially looking at the process. But one area did come up, and I just wanted to make sure that I acknowledge this, is that in a visit that I made separately from the president's evaluation to ELCO, the classified staff pointed out specifically that our policy does not specifically mention that during the review process that we should do an outreach to classified staff. Now, we've done that in each of those evaluations, but I think it does a point very well taken. It makes a very clear point that we meet with faculty, that we meet with students, and not classified staff. And I will be rectifying that and bringing that forward, too, because we do evaluate their input, and I think it was a point well taken. So thank you.
Thank you, Chancellor Riley. We will go to the Chair's report. First, today's the 75th anniversary D-Date, so I'd like to thank all our service members and veterans for their service. Again, ditto on all the people during the legislative session. I won't go through them all, but we appreciate the team effort on that. Also, I want to say Vice Chair Geddes looks very good today and would like to have him stand up for a minute. So this is, yep. Now, when we gave it to him the first year, he said, why did you get such a nice jersey? And I told him you're going to be wearing it every year, and he has every year except for 1 year, 6 out of 7. years he wore it, and I forgot that the one year that he didn't wear it is actually a tie. And so on a tiebreaker, I had to wear the jersey for 1 year. So, and actually the score was 34.5 to 13.5 this year. So congratulations to UNOV.
Thanks, Doug Knuth.
And want to say that we will be having a special board meeting next Friday, 9 a.m., to talk about the 3% COLA. And for the board, if you could let Winter know whether you're going to attend the meeting in person or call in. And with that, we will go to agenda item number 9, consent items. Motion for approval for Regent Trachuk. Do we have a second? Second from Regent Perkins. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
I'm assuming in favor, correct?
Yes, that was an aye. Thank you.
Okay, no, perfect. Okay, motion passes. We are going to go to item number 10, election of officers. Chief of Staff Gould.
Okay, the ever-popular election of officers. So I thought I would start by just setting some of the rules, particularly for the people who haven't done this before. Per Article 4, Section 2 of the bylaws, the chair and vice chair should be elected from among the membership of the board at the last organizational meeting of the board held during the board's last meeting of the fiscal year and shall serve a one-year term to commence on the following July 1. So we will start with the election of chair. This is the time set for the election of the chair of the Board of Regents for the fiscal year starting July 1, 2019 through June 30, 2020.
Okay, with that, I open up nominations for chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to nominate Regent Hayes for the position of chair.
We have a nomination for Regent Hayes. Regent Cole.
I would like to nominate Vice Chair Geddes.
Okay. Seeing no other nominations, we will close nominations. Okay, Regent Hayes, if you're elected, will you serve?
I will, sir.
Okay.
Vice Chair Geddes?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With that, we will do a roll call vote.
Okay, so when I call your name, please tell me who you would vote for of the two nominees, either Regent Geddes or Regent Hayes, please. Okay. So up first today is Regent Lieberman.
Regent Geddes.
Regent McAdoo.
Regent Geddes.
Regent McMichael.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Moran. I'm going to note him as absent. Chair Page.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Perkins.
Regent Hayes.
Regent Trachuk.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Carter.
Regent Hayes.
Regent Carvalho.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Del Carlo.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Dubrava.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Geddes.
Regent Hayes.
I'll go with Hayes.
Okay. Regent Geddes, you have won. Congratulations. You are the chair-elect of the Board of Regents.
We'd now like to open up nominations for vice chair. Regent Lieberman.
I'd like to nominate Regent Patrick Carter.
Okay, Regent Hayes, we have Patrick Carter. Regent Lieberman.
Regent Mark Dubrava.
Okay, Regent Dubrava. Any other nominations? Okay, seeing none. Regent Dubrava, will you serve? If yes. And Regent Carter?
Yes.
Okay. With that, we're going to close vice chair nominations and go to a roll call vote.
Okay, this one will start with Regent McAdoo.
Regent Dubrava.
Regent McMichael.
Regent Dubrava.
Regent Moran. Note him as absent. Chair Page.
Regent Dubrava.
Regent Perkins.
Regent Dubrava.
Regent Trachuk.
Regent DeBrava.
Regent Carter.
Regent Carter.
Regent Carvalho.
Regent DeBrava.
Regent Del Carlo.
Regent DeBrava.
Regent DeBrava. Vice Chair Geddes.
Regent DeBrava.
Regent Hayes.
Carter.
Regent Lieberman.
DeBrava.
Regent DeBrava wins. Congratulations, Vice Chair-elect DeBrava.
With that, we're going to take a 9-minute break and come back at 2:10. Good item number 11, Handbook Revisions, ENCHI, Core Records, and College Ready Gateway Policy. Vice Chair Aber and Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chair Page. Today we will consider a policy on co-requisite remediation that will support the Board's strategic goal of improving student success. If adopted, the policy will mandate that all students must be enrolled in the college-level English and mathematics courses. Students who need additional support will receive it simultaneously in a co-requisite course that will provide just-in-time support. As you know from Theo Meek's presentation at the March meeting, state and national data support this approach because it has been proven to improve overall student success. Remedial education nationally is a failure. It is overpopulated with poor kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and even when remediated, students don't move on. Today, we'll also hear from Dr. Heidi Loschbaugh about the co-requisite experience at the Community College of Denver. Denver's adoption of co-requisite support resulted in increased completions, improved time to degree, and reduced costs for students. I feel it's important for the Board to hear from an institution that has already traveled down this road. We're asking to delay implementation until fall of 2021. This is the feedback we've heard from our faculty. It is a recommendation that we wholeheartedly support their involvement in the implementation. Their leadership in this is very important. The two-year lead time to the policy's effective date allows the institutions the necessary time to implement the policy. Further, we will bring in national experts, including faculty from other states, to support our institutions through the implementation phase. During this time, the institutions will establish implementation action plans that will come before the Board. Finally, the proposed policy includes a provision of experimental programs, and I want to make sure everyone understands this, a conversation, again, that we've had with faculty. Instead of doing a blanket approval to exclude certain populations, we're asking the Board to adopt the policy. But that doesn't mean we can't come back before the Board. But what I would like the institutions to do is to come back to the Board for approval so the Board stays continuously involved in this and they develop a program that has metrics, that's based on best practices, and they can do that any time during the two-year period. Institutions don't have to come back in September. They can come back in December or another time to talk about this in a program that they're committed to that will collect data, and then we can look at best practices. And then the Board's active involvement, you can change it as you move forward. So that's why I'd like that we do a point at each of our Board meetings to ensure that faculty are involved. And that as we need to make changes, we make those changes. But I want to be clear that what we want to do is the recommendation is to adopt the policy now, but allow for our faculty and allow for the institutions to come back and suggest these are programs that we would like to implement. And this is based upon best data. This is metrics that we're actually going to collect. However, what I want to make clear is that the experimental programs will not replace the co-requisite, but they'll be adding the data and the experience that might be necessary as we move forward in the implementation of this. I'd like to reiterate that this is a strong first step in changing the culture of higher education. When students come to our campuses, they will be taking college-level courses. Instead of making students, instead of making sure that the students are ready for us, we're making sure that we're ready to meet the needs of Nevada students. So with that, I want to turn this over to Vice Chancellor Abba.
Good afternoon. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. I will actually be brief. I'm going to cover basically where we've been in the last 6 weeks since you gave me the request of developing this policy. We're going to talk a little bit about the forums. Theo will then follow me. You heard from Theo in March when he presented his report that is also included in the reference material. We're going to highlight some of that data to remind you of what the challenge is that we are facing and why this policy is aimed at correcting the challenges that we face. In addition, really the best part of this agenda item, more important than hearing from Theo and I, is hearing from Dr. Heidi Loschbaugh. Dr. Heidi Loschbaugh comes from us from UC Boulder. However, she was on the ground as the dean of the Math and Science Center at the Community College of Denver. They have been down this road. They know exactly where the potholes are at. They had challenges, but they have seen significant returns. And those returns have been measured by an external entity, the Boston Consulting Group. So if you have any reservation, I consider Heidi the co-requisite crusader, and she is very passionate about this, as I am. Actually, in some respects, I think we're twins, except for the hair length. She's incredible, and she is absolutely candid. So I invite you, because it's rare that we can look to another state, another college, or have an individual in front of us at the time we're adopting the policy. So this is a really unique opportunity to talk to someone who's already been there, and that institution has reaped considerable benefits from the policy. So just quick history to remind everyone, not the past 6 weeks, but if we go back further, we have been discussing co-requisite mathematics in particular in this system for over 5 years. If you go back to 2014, when we had the initial discussions with Complete College America on the development of the Gateway policy, the impetus behind that at that time was a national dialogue that was emerging that was recommending co-requisite mathematics. We weren't ready to go there for several reasons. One of the most primary reasons was the fact that if you go back 5 years ago, while it was emerging across the nation, there really wasn't a lot of longitudinal data on that. Now we're seeing states and institutions that have gone down this road, so the data, the story, the reason behind this, the experience behind this now is well-founded and well-measured by external entities. What we did at that time, though, was we crafted the Gateway policy, which basically says a student, when they enroll in our institution, has to be placed on a pathway for the completion of the Gateway course within 1 year or 3 semesters if they are in a STEM pathway. Now, institutions that took the step that UNR initially did and have already, to some extent, adopted COREC, they met the mandate of that policy. So COREC is permissible under the policy and does what the board is already asking. You are taking this a step further today by saying we want to change the culture, because one of the challenges of the current policy is that there's an out. There is a loophole in there that basically says that students that place below high school level do not have to be put on that pathway. And the reason we did that, and again, remember, it goes back to that task force report that was on the prior slide. When we looked at this, we felt that it was very difficult at that time to get students through in that time period. And again, we didn't see a lot of data that showed students below high school level succeeding with this, but we see that now. Again, that's the Tennessee data, and we're going to be reminded of that in Theo's presentation. So what we saw with that exception in the Gateway policy was we had some institutions that funneled more students into below high school level, and as a result, you look at those success rates and they are significantly lower than other populations of students. So today, what you're effectively doing when you adopt this policy is you are making an incredibly strong statement that says not only are we saying you have to have COREC, but what it basically does is it changes the culture for higher ed in this state by saying if you're going to come to a college in Nevada, you're going to take college-level coursework. That's a huge step and a huge shift from where we've been in the past. Think about that for a second. You come to college, you're going to take college courses. But if you come to college and you're going to take college-level courses and you need help, we're going to make sure you have the help when you need it. And that's basically fundamentally what co-requisite is. It's making sure that you have just-in-time support right when you need it, as opposed to several semesters before. Just talked about that. So now I'm going to turn it over to Theo, and he's going to go over, remind you of some of the data that you saw in March.
Good afternoon. Theo Meek, research scholar, Nevada System of Higher Education. I think at this point everyone understands the idea of co-requisite support, which is to provide the remedial foundations that students need at the time that they're going to use it. So I will gloss over my cooking metaphor that I thought of one night in that, you know, when you go to make something, you don't read the recipe a year before you're actually going to make whatever you're going to make. In my case, it was pasta. I use YouTube, and I use an ingredient list, and I use the directions at the exact moment that I'm going to make the pasta. That's the idea of co-requisite. We're giving the students the recipe and the tools that they need at the time that they are going to make their pasta. Their pasta is made in Math 120 and Math 126, English 101 and English 102. What we know from the policy paper that is part of the supplemental material, which you've seen already, is that traditional remediation is not working. It's not working in the nation, as our chancellor said, and it's also not working within this system. Too many students start in a remedial pathway. Students face psychological barriers of being told that they're not yet college material, but after three or four courses, you may be eligible to be college material and take college-level courses. And we also know that closing the achievement gap, one of our key strategies and focuses of this group, starts with reforming our remediation because of the significant number of underrepresented minorities, Pell-eligible students, of students that are enrolled in traditional remediation. Co-requisite support results in much higher student success outcomes, and again, you will see today that is true across all levels of academic preparedness. Even for the students that come in with the highest needs for remediation, they are more successful in the co-requisite option than they are in traditional pathways. Early successes at UNR and Nevada State College, which have long adopted the co-requisite method and have been piloting those programs, those successes show that co-requisite remediation works within our system as well. And again, regardless of academic preparation, success is more likely for students that participate in a co-requisite model than in the traditional prerequisite model. Again, there is an overrepresentation of minority students in our remediation, and that's true at it's true within the nation, and it's true within our state. The slide that you see here shows the number of students that are enrolled in remediation, and we know that placement and enrollment are different problems. Our placement rates are even higher than enrollment rates because, of course, there's a number of students who are not enrolling into the required courses. From a placement standpoint, two-thirds of our American Indian and Alaskan Native students are placed into remediation within our community colleges. 56% of our Black students are enrolled into remediation, and then again, a significantly higher number are placed into remediation. There is an overrepresentation of minority students in remediation. To help operationalize this idea, I just wanted to break it down to think about if we were looking at a system of just 100 students. For every 100 students that place into remedial math within NC's community colleges, 59 will go on to enroll into the required course within their first year, be it their first course less than high school, at the high school level, such as Math 95 or Math 96, 59 will go on to enroll. 30 will enroll into their gateway course within the first year. 24 will go on to complete the gateway course within the first year. And historic NC data, which you've seen on our policy paper, traditional remediation is not working, says that 8% of students who place in traditional remediation at community colleges will go on to graduate. 8 out of 100. That leaves 92 students who are either still in the system, spiraling, accumulating credits, accumulating excessive student debt, or students that have completely left higher education within the state without a degree to show for it, missed opportunity costs of working and lost wages, which you'll hear from Dr. Loshbaugh in the Boston Consulting Group. The focus is on these 92 students. There are 8 students in our system that are successful. We should celebrate those 8 students. With moving forward in a co-requisite model, we are not going to lose the success of those 8 students. There is only success to be gained from the 92 that have no credential or degree of value to show for their work. Traditional remediation, this is our slide from Tennessee. The math, when you compare the prerequisite model to the co-requisite model at Tennessee, we see that at all levels of preparedness, students are more successful in the co-requisite model. And again, you'll see even at the lowest levels with an ACT of less than a 13, which is a very low ACT score, those students are far more, 11 times more successful in a co-requisite model than they are in traditional prerequisite models of remediation. Now, 33%, again, is nothing to stop our work and retire upon, but it is a significant gain from where we're at right now, because the 3% looks like those low percentages look very similar to what we see within our own system. Adult learners are no exception to this. Adult learners want expedited pathways. They want to go in, they want to take the courses that they need, they want to earn that degree or certificate of value and go back into the workforce or work simultaneously while working on their degrees. Providing a co-requisite option for them shortens their time to degree and provides them more clear outlines for how to get to their degree in a timely fashion. For adult learners, even again at the lowest levels of academic preparedness, those adult learners that are coming in with a 14, those are our adult learners that are placing into courses below the high school level. They are dramatically more successful in the co-requisite model, 7 times more successful across the board. And for our English students, the benefits of co-requisite support it is not an exception. For students, again, at the lowest levels of academic underpreparedness, coming in with an ACT of a 12 that might place them into a reading 95 or a deeply remedial English course, they are at least 3 times more successful in the co-requisite model. We are not alone in adopting this, and you will hear from Dr. Loschbaugh, who is just one logo on this slide that you see, but there are many states, many systems that have taken on co-requisite reform. And with that, I will pass it back off to Vice Chancellor Abba.
So very quickly on the policy, if you refer to the reference material under 11C, I'm going to take you quickly through some of the subsections just to highlight a couple of issues. But before I do so, I want to explain what happened during the course of the forum. So we held 3 public forums. We invited everyone. We had great showings, lots of faculty from both North and South, administrators. One of the concerns that we had to deal with initially was that folks were under the impression that we were eliminating remediation. We're not eliminating remediation. We're saying that you're going to provide that remediation when the student needs it. There is exceptions in the policy. There's 2 basic exceptions. One of them is for students that are in high school. So if you have a JumpStart program and you're providing 95 in high school, that's okay, because we're not putting them in the gateway course. The difference, however, is that we're trying to change the dialogue on that, so that if you notice the language in subsection 2B, we refer to that as college preparatory courses, because taking 95 in high school, it's appropriate high school content that prepares them for college. So we're making a conscious effort to change the dialogue around that. Obviously, there were some concerns that were raised. Faculty expressed concerns that we lack the requirement. We are going to have a challenge finding some faculty, especially for the community colleges. Right now, they have a lot of LOAs that teach remedial courses. When you combine this and you're teaching the gateway course, you're going to bump right up against accreditation. We need master's prepared faculty. That will be one of the issues that we will grapple with when we create an implementation task force that I speak about in a moment. So let's go on and talk about the task force. So we plan on creating a task force that's going to be at the system level. And when I spoke with the academic officers yesterday, I'm recommending that the institutions actually have their own task forces as well, because I can't have a task force of 60 people. It becomes unmanageable. But if we have a task force with 2 or 3 representatives from each institution, obviously to include math and English, those individuals would act as a liaison with the institutional task force or the math and English faculty at the institution. What we really want to do through this implementation effort at the system level, which is unique to what we've done in the past, is to make sure that we're providing support to our faculty. So we're going to ask the faculty that are part of the implementation task force, what do you want? And I'm assuming that they're going to say, can we please talk to some other faculty that have already done this? What did they do in terms of changes in curriculum? What did they do in terms of changes in pedagogy? They're going to want to hear from other people that have gone down this road. So we're going to bring those people to Nevada to help us. We're also going to try to do a site visit where we go to a call. We've looked at some schools in Colorado. We may end up going somewhere else. We haven't figured that out yet. But basically what we want to do is to use that system-level implementation task force to grapple with everything from common course numbering to resources, because there will be a price tag to this, obviously. And you'll notice that there is no fiscal note attached to this because we don't know what this is actually going to look like yet. There are a lot of different ways to do co-rec in terms of the curriculum and, again, pedagogy, and those will be decisions that will be made by the faculty. Our job now is to support them and make sure that we give them what they need so that they can go down this path and be a success. Now, when you hear from Heidi, she's going to explain that the community college in Denver, they bumped their head a couple of times, and they may need to make some adjustments, and we are going to need to make some adjustments as well. And I expect that those adjustments will not only come in terms of the courses and what they look like, the pathways and what they look like, but the policy as well. It is highly likely that I will be back here before fall of 21 saying, okay, during the course of implementation, we realized X, Y, or Z, and as a result, we are proposing an amendment to that policy. There's also a provision in here, if you'll notice, on the very last page, and it says it's effective upon passage, and it basically concerns co-admission. And that's effective on passage because we have some institutions that are going to move down this road this fall. CSN is one example, UNLV as well. And when they do that, we want to make sure that other provisions of the policy will support that, and co-admission is one of those pieces. So that's why you see the difference in the effective dates there. So we've covered the policy in general and the exceptions. The last thing I want to quickly talk about is the experimental program. So as the chancellor indicated, this is not in any way to supplant co-requisite. You can't come back with an experimental program and say that my cohort is the entire student population of all degree-seeking students. Institutions will come back and define a cohort. They will set their own metrics. It'll be reviewed by their office. And we want them to share that with you. We want them to bring it to you and explain what they're doing, and because it's an act of innovation, and we want the board and we want the public to be aware of that. If they are successful and they have models that are equally or more successful than co-rec, one of the questions that I've been asked is, well, what do we do then? Well, we're going to have to go back and revisit the policy, because that may be an exception we then make at the institution for that particular institution, by tier for institution type, or we go back and say, okay, wait a second, we figured out something that the rest of the nation hasn't figured out. Let's go back and relook at the policy. Because the key to all of this, as you know from the fact that we just tackled the whole remediation issue when we created the Gateway policy, and we've been talking about remediation for decades, and I expect that we will continue to talk about it because there is no silver bullet out there, but board policy is organic. But each time we strengthen this policy, we are digging deeper in terms of increasing the numbers of students that are completing that Gateway course in the first year. And you know from the data that you've seen before that those students that complete the Gateway course within the first year are much more likely to graduate. So the underlying purpose of all of this is to support your goal, to support the Chancellor's goal for improving student success. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Heidi. And she's going to talk about the experience again in at the Community College of Denver. Dr. Loshbaugh.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Heidi Loshbaugh. That is spelled L-O-S-H-B-A-U-G-H. As mentioned, I'm a researcher at University of Colorado Boulder. Education research is my area of expertise. The experience that I'm going to describe to you, I was the dean for math and science at Community College of Denver. Some of the demographic statistics of Community College of Denver. It is located in downtown Denver, Colorado. It shares a campus with two universities in the heart of Denver. It's one of 13 colleges in the Colorado Community College system. Its student population is made up of approximately 63% first-generation students, 60% Pell-eligible students, 52% of those students are minorities, and 31% are Latinx. And so it is a vibrant, multicultural, multidimensional institution with many students who have not had prior experience in higher education. It is a gateway. However, it historically had been considered Colorado's developmental education college because of the high number of students who were enrolled in developmental coursework. 2015, there were several pieces that came together that I started asking the math team, are we doing the right thing, or is there something that we need to fix? So this slide demonstrates some of the considerations that we looked at. One was that co-requisite instruction was becoming more and more common across the United States. Colorado was in the process of implementing a flawed placement test. It was to replace the AccuPlacer, but as the state worked on this proprietary test, we discovered that it was going to be even more challenging than the AccuPlacer, and it was going to have much higher likelihood of misplacement. In addition, I was doing quite a bit of reading on research findings about how unreliable placement tests are. They don't get students in the right math course, and then students are wasting their time, they're wasting their money, and honestly, they are wasting their goodwill in institutions that have not put them in the place that they need to be successful. Most CCD students were placed below college level, and at one point had as many as four semesters before they entered a gateway math class. There was very low credential completion amongst students who were placed in developmental education, over-reliance on college algebra as a transfer course, and yet historically, no matter what my team did in math education, college algebra was stuck at a 50% successful completion rate. So we had over-enrollment in college algebra and significantly under-success performance there. So that became a tremendous barrier. There had been a 2014 reform in Colorado that was conducted across developmental education. That was before I had responsibility for the DevEd math team. I had at that time only the college-level math team. That pathways reform led to significant compression of remediation. In 2015, when we started looking at this reform, we did calculations and realized that even with compression of DevEd reform, CCD students in math only developmental education had spent $7.5 million on tuition, not one dime of which was a transferable college credit. And for me, that became an ethical issue. I said, we have to do better. And so the math team and I started working on what better looked like. So to describe briefly, this is what the history of reform looked like at Colorado's DevEd College. We historically had the four-semester remediation practice. The first level of reform that came in 2014 compressed that into a one-semester developmental education process. The second reform introduced in 2016 meant that we placed students directly into their college-level class with a one-credit support lab. That one-credit support lab was tuition-bearing. It was one-credit hour with two contact hours for each week. Now, something that came up in a meeting that I had with a team of faculty yesterday was questions about what happened after the first reform. I wanted to bring to your attention that at CCD there was declining enrollment as we saw Colorado's economy rebound after the recession starting in 2008. CCD, which its enrollment had peaked at a headcount of over 19,000, started to decline as the economy improved. That decline continued, and it was concurrent with this shift in developmental education policy. That led to a need to reduce the number of developmental education faculty. That is a fact, but it is not caused by the DevEd reform. It is concurrent with that reform. And there is anxiety in Nevada about whether or not people will lose their jobs. And one of the things that Nevada is very visionary about, and she is already looking at, how do we make sure that people who are in our DevEd faculty workforce are able to continue by working through a collaborative arrangement to ensure that those folks can get the graduate credentials they need to continue supporting Nevada students toward their educational success. So one of the lessons learned from CCD would be making sure that there is support for faculty to continue. Now, if we look at co-requisite remediation and its ability, this is what happened in real time at Community College of Denver. That first band at the top looks at prerequisite remediation. We had 100 students enroll in that lowest level of developmental mathematics. And as students made their way through, there was drop-off each time until the Gateway Mathematics course, only 4 of those students completed. So we lost 96% of students. And you can imagine that even though we had a high DevEd enrollment, that essentially meant we had a turnstile in terms of student success. Students would come in and they would end up back out. That's a problem. With the one semester remediation, we increased to 34 successful completers with 2 semesters to complete. And that essentially reduced us to 4.5 enrollments per completer. But we were still able to do better than that when we went to full-scale co-requisite instruction, which meant that of the 100 who enrolled in the college-level course with the co-req support lab, 54 completed in their first semester. And so that is a substantial improvement that led to 3.7 enrollments per completer. If you look then at, there are a couple of pieces in this very dense slide, which is in your packets, and you can look at it more carefully. But some of the important takeaways. One is, if you look down at the bottom, the average number of college-level credits accumulated in the first year improved from 2011, when we had the 4-semester developmental sequence, to the full-scale co-requisite remediation. It increased 78%. When students accumulate credits at a more rapid rate, they are much more likely to stay in college. They don't get burned out. Life doesn't get in the way. They don't run out of money. They are able to stay in and complete a certificate or a degree. If you look at the impact on Pell students, it was an 85% gain. If you look at underrepresented minority students, it was a 94% gain. And so that increase is substantial. If you look at the cost category, again, there are a number of pieces embedded in this data. It was the tuition time, the cost per semester, the books, and it was the lost wages that students had that were calculated in this formula. It led to essentially an $18.5 million savings across the entering population of students who started in fall of 2016. From my perspective, and going back to what I mentioned a moment ago, I consider this to be an ethical issue. The status quo is failing everybody. It's failing students and their families, communities, employers. It fails K-12 and higher education by duplicating settings and limiting capacity. It is essentially a deficit to faculty and staff. People work incredibly hard every day, and if you know that you are going to see 4 students who are successful and 96 who are not, that is really discouraging to know that people come in every day and work hard. So to make the commitment to do something different is visionary, and it is going to support greater success for Nevada citizens. Co-requisite instruction empowers students. It also empowers faculty. Our students deserve better. It comes as an asset approach. It completely revises this notion of Nevada students can't, Nevada students don't, Nevada students don't even. If you move away from a deficit mindset toward an asset approach, this is what our students can do. We're here to help them do better. That is how co-requisite instruction can make a big difference. I'm going to tell you, it is hard work. Let me repeat, it's hard work. And so the commitment on the part of institutions to support faculty and staff through that hard work is critical. It will require new curricular design and delivery support. It requires creativity and experimentation. And so allowing tolerance for students To learn in a new way means that faculty have to learn as well. So the experimental options that are being discovered or being discussed, that is a critical component. Faculty institutions can seek guidance from prior research and implementation sites coming out of West Virginia, Maryland, Florida, Tennessee, Colorado, California. There are lots of folks who are doing this work. Nevada is not alone. And so learning from that prior work is a great benefit. Faculty can achieve new professional milestones by supporting student success and by their own professional development. Essentially, the education that we have in mathematics today developed during the moonshot race. It goes back to the 1960s. That is an old model, although I had to joke yesterday with the folks I spoke to in that only last week we started talking in the U.S. about going back to the moon, and so this slide may be a little bit dated from when I wrote it last month. Co-requisite instruction responds to contemporary needs. It allows faculty and institutions to focus resources more intentionally, and implementing co-req allows students to do better. It is a risk that is worth taking, and so I applaud you for considering that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Question? Regent Carter.
Yes, a couple quick questions, I guess. So in the 16 rollout, when you rolled out the 103, 107, 108, that's like math for clinical calculations, career math, technical mathematics.
Yes.
Did that shift a lot of the people out of the main algebra class to these other classes, or did you see the enrollment in algebra stay pretty consistent? Or?
That's an excellent question. Thank you very much for asking that question. So I believe I mentioned that we had historically seen over-enrollment in college algebra. And as I recall it, we had over 60% of CCD students placed in college algebra, but less than 40% of those students actually needed college algebra for their pathway. So yes, we did see a shift, but that was something that we looked for, that we intended, and that we planned. So I actually went through all of the enrollment sheets in college algebra in fall of 16 before the semester launched. And if a student did not have a engineering pathway or a mathematics pathway, I talked to their advisor, I talked to the dean of student retention and said, why is this student placed here? And if they are here for a reason other than their degree, we need to really consult with them carefully.
Regent Carter.
Vice Chancellor Abba, so is there anything in our policy that would prevent our community colleges from having career math, technical mathematics, financial mathematics, all these other types of math classes specific to their program?
I'm sorry, you mean embedded in the program? No. That's completely permissible under the policy.
So in the new policy, it says or equivalent for a certificate program. So that should that say associate's program? That's under 2.
You mean 2A?
This would be Section 1, 2E2A, yes.
So when we use the term degree-seeking, we're assuming all degree levels, and then certificate-seeking would just be those certificates that are at least 30 credits or below 30 credits, so the two categories that we have. So it basically covers the entire spectrum.
So then if they did have those classes like the 107, 103...
Thanks. Oh, yes, that's part of it.
It would be fine.
107,
for the
103 are considered the gateway course for those particular programs.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good.
I'm sorry.
And then under number one, it says, and she reserves the right to cancel admission or registration of any individual whose attendance at the university, et cetera. So is that limiting enrollment, or do we have any idea how many people that would affect?
So that language in subsection 1 is actually related to federal financial aid, the ability to benefit, and it's been on the books for forever, so we always keep that language there. It's actually unrelated to the bold italics, which is the new language in the policy.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Regent Trachok.
Yes, Chairman, I'd like to move that we adopt the policy as presented and change in the language as presented.
Second from Regent DiCarlo. Any discussion? Regent DiCarlo.
I've got a few things that I just wanted to point out. First, I'm hearing a lot of disagreement from faculty on this. And maybe not just faculty, I shouldn't say it that way, but there are different groups that are worried about the implementation of this, and Doug has his hand up. Oh, okay. And while I hear those issues, and frankly, it sounds to me like a fear of what's going, what we're voting on now. I think we're all here for the future of Nevada and its students. We haven't done a good job with graduating students, preparing them for the next level in their education. We just haven't done a good job with that. And I'm not sure if sticking with the status quo is going to work for that. And from my perspective, it seems like we've talked about this for a long time, and we need more actionable policies in order to make this happen. So I do want to say that it's very important that all of the institutions must be involved in this. I appreciate the task forces that you described, Vice Chancellor Abba, and I really hope that you take their work and participation into consideration, because that's where the success of this is going to lie, with faculty and institution buy-in. So we must be able to do that. I know that it's a two-year implementation process, and I hope that a lot of work is done before this so that faculty and institutions are on board and feel comfortable with where they're at with this. My other concern is about the high-stakes placement exams like ACCUPLACER, and that we may be placing too many students below high school level. Through your implementation discussions, can you explore a policy limiting or prohibiting the use of ACCUPLACER as a placement tool? Or perhaps there are other measures of preparedness that may be more effective in placing students. At one of our earlier meetings today at ARSA, I saw the charts that many students in our institutions are older, especially part-time students, and many of those fit into this co-requisite model, and we need to make sure that we're placing them correctly and not just, here, take a test, and you're in what this test demonstrates. I also read something just the other day, and I can't find it, so I'm sorry that I won't quote, but it was about a student who was not prepared through all of his K-12 time, and then went to college and realized that the college expected a lot more of him, and he rose to the challenge. So we need to understand that our students want to be in college, and they will raise their work and their proficiency if we expect that of them. Thank you.
We're going to go to Vice Chair Geddes and Professor Unger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to echo a point that Regent Carvalho made, and it's we've been doing it a long time, and we have not made great strides, and this is a change that I think we have to make and we have to implement, and we've got to improve the remediation. And the data that Dr. Loshbaugh presented there is very compelling, and I was fortunate enough to sit in on a forum that she did with a lot of the faculty senate and English and math faculty yesterday, where she answered questions for an hour and a half or more that were coming up, and she's lent herself as an asset to the system. I think the 2 years gives us plenty of time to look at it, make sure we get it right, implement it, knowing we're going to have to make changes. But we do have to support this today. And what I would like to ask, though, is that we get regular reports back to the board as far as progress, so that we can hear the concerns faculty are having, see what the progress is in implementing it everywhere, so that we know we will be good to go in the fall of 21. Thank you.
Professor Unger.
yes. The chairs have met with Vice Chancellor Abba and Dr. Mook and others last Friday, and we talked through a lot of these issues. One question that we have that was a little unclear from Vice Chancellor Abba's slide is, will the NCHE task force include faculty from the most affected institutions as you're busy shaping the implementation plan?
Absolutely. Like I said, I'm grappling with the size, but right now, kind of where I'm at in my head, and I haven't figured this out completely, I will completely concede that, is that I need math and English representation from every single institution. But again, I think what will be critical to this is that as institutions, you have your own implementation task force that's much broader than that, so that your math faculty member can act as a liaison with your broader math group that's responsible for implementation. Same thing on the English side. Because, I truly see that the faculty, that the task force for implementation, we're there to provide support. Okay, I can't tell you what should be in the curriculum, and I can't tell you what pedagogy is going to look like. I can't tell you what the pathway is going to look like, and the policy doesn't do that. That is in the purview of the faculty. So basically, we're giving you it's a huge experimental program because we want you to figure that out and we want you to take ownership for it. But our responsibility and the responsibility, I think, of the board is that we make sure that you have the support in doing so. So absolutely.
The major concern of faculty throughout our schools is that they be involved in the task force for the implementation in a regular way. And I think that can be worked out with our individual institutional task force. The second concern that's come up has to do with, I believe it's Section 2, the continuous enrollment policy that is a part of the policy. And that's a request of NCHE to give us some flexibility with that as we analyze the different resource requirements of our individual schools. If underprepared students are required to enroll in both math and English in the first semester, it may cause some classroom and resource and instructor difficulties that we would like a commitment from the system to work with. In other words, we're on board with the policy. We'd just like to be able to figure out how to do it within our existing resources and to have faculty involvement and be able to take the implementation plan back to our Faculty Senate curriculum committees and make the appropriate responses to the policy in the form of new curriculum or revisions of existing curriculum. And I think we're all on board if we can just have that much flexibility in terms of, especially then also the resource question. We also suggested that the community college committee and the academic committee of subcommittees of the Board of Regents be the committees to whom we report on a quarterly basis what our results are as we're beginning to implement this policy. I mean, that was just a suggestion that came out of our Friday meeting.
Thank you. We're going to go here and then over there.
Hello. My name is Alexandra. I am the student government president of Truckee Meadows Community College, and I just wanted to say that there's probably a reason that a lot of students are not able to pass remedial math or just math in general. I know I have a lot of friends who are from Galena High School, and they tried to accuplace into 126, and it took them 4 or 5 times, even though they were in traditional schooling. I was homeschooled throughout my life, and so I went on YouTube for math and to learn about math, and the math tutors there were probably the best math teachers I've ever seen. I think that this generation relies on YouTube tutorials for their math classes. And I think that if we are going to change how it's being taught, how are colleges going to find a balance between creative teaching versus traditional educational teaching when, you know, changing this curriculum?
Thank you.
Thank you, Abby Peters, Faculty Senate Chair, Nevada State College. Also just want to bring up involving the students. How do we message this? Some students have a comfort in taking remedial. They might not feel ready for college, and I understand we want to change that narrative too. Like, you are ready for college, but there are those who just want a remedial, just a refresher or something like that. And so working with the students, talking with our social psychologists, and how do we message what we're asking them to go into when they might have had people in their family, their friends, who've taken a different path, and they're like, oh, I thought that I could do this kind of refresher course before I have to do college of math. And so just thinking about the student perspective, I know that Nevada State College has collected some data on folks who have students who have gone through the remedial, and would they do it again, and would they recommend it to a friend or a classmate. So just to keep that in mind as well with the task force.
Okay. Seeing nothing else with that, Regent Carter.
I just wanted a clarification. At this point, if we pass this, they're supposed to come up with institutional action plans. And then do we want to set a deadline or a timeline for them to bring that institutional action plan back to us? And if we do, could that be a friendly amendment to the person who made the motion? Like those, was that Rachel?
Yes.
If you don't mind, I'd like to get through a couple of implementation task force meetings because I don't know reasonably what this is going to take in terms of time to develop. And so I'm hesitant to say let's set a deadline today. Part of this is obviously some of this is going to have to be in course catalogs in time for fall 21. So my expectation right now, just so you know, not having actually thought this through from beginning to end, is that by January we'll start telling we'll create a schedule basically of, okay, you know, two or three institutions at each board meeting will present to ARSA on their action plans. So we're aiming, and that way they'll have ample time if the board does have feedback or concerns that they can go back then next calendar year and make adjustments. But before you put a deadline on me, because the last one was challenging enough, if I could just have a little bit of leeway there, I would be appreciative.
As the mover, I would say that if we had anybody other than Vice Chancellor Abba in charge of this, I might be concerned about the deadlines, but I'm not.
Thank you for your confidence.
Chancellor Riley, if I could add, Regent Carter, one thought is that we just bring this back as a touch point at all our quarterly meetings. I think then you as a board can have a comfort level that we're moving forward, you're up to date on it, and it's important enough cultural change that we're having, I think it would warrant that. And that at any point you can give us direction on that too as we progress.
Regent DiCarlo.
Thank you, Chair Page. I also agree that we should have this come back to the community college for updates because this is really going to affect the four community colleges. So thank you.
Okay. With that, we're going to vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Abstentions? Motion passes. Item number 12, personnel session has been withdrawn, and we will move to item number 13, community college report. Regent DiCarlo.
Thank you, Chair Page. The community college committee met on April 19th. There was no public comment. We started with the vice chancellor's report. He introduced our new MGM senior learning concierge, Danielle Donato. He stated that the IACs at TMCC and GBC are both looking for new leaders. We had a very informative presentation by Starfish with their personnel, and it was presented by the CSN because they have taken the lead in Habit, and because of leveraging of the community colleges, the four together, that Starfish is going to be at all the community colleges. It features student retention scores, career exploration tools, intervention, and strategic consulting. And GBC and WNC will begin in the fall this year. And we will revisit this, the results, in 6 to 12 months on the committee. We did have the institutional advisory councils all gave updates. And also the each institution gave an update. You heard those updates this morning with the reports from each community college. CSN did report they're in the middle of their mid-cycle evaluation report. It's going well. Vice Chancellor McKinnon gave a update on the Nevada Promise. TMCC, I'll do a shout-out, leads the community colleges with a 41% of new applicants still eligible as of April 1st, so good job there. at the time of the meeting, of course, stuff was still going through the Senate Bill 350, and we heard that this morning in the legislative update. It was announced that the Association of Community College Trustees has their Leadership Congress in San Francisco. There's four awards that are given. The deadline's already passed on June 10th for different awards. We talked about having a community college staff award. We didn't make any decisions, but we thought down the road we would do that. I'm trying to go through this quickly. Kyle Dalpe gave a really informative legislative update at the WNC IAC. And TMCC reported that they are mid-cycle on their accreditation, too. Significant progress has been made by them. CSM reported a 10% increase in completion of Gateway Math and a 13% increase in completion in Gateway English. And this has resulted in being ranked among the best in the country. So good job there. And Rob Hooper gave unique college highlights for their IAC. And a shout-out to President Solis for doing a tremendous job reaching out to the various communities and building relationships in the WNC region. And that's it. We new business down the road. We want to know how regions can be more helpful and supportive of the IAC, how the roads program will affect us in the future, and update on the MGM program in June. So that's my report. I think I have something to read at the end. Hold on. Let me get it passed.
Okay, so we have motion for approval.
Okay.
Thank you. Second by Regent Trachak. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
We're going to go to item number 15 has been polled, and we're going to go to item number 16, personnel session, President Joyce Hellens, GBC, Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chair Page. So consistent with the findings of the evaluation committee, I believe that President Hellens has performed very well over the evaluation period. The evaluation was done in accordance with NC procedures and policy manual as established by this board. Accordingly, I created a committee of four community leaders, including one senior faculty member. The committee was comprised of Jeannie Collette Ofsted, a community member and daughter of GBC founder, Zach Gerber, who is an attorney and is also with the GBC Foundation trustee, Stacy Smith, the chief executive officer for Nye Communities Coalition, and Stephen Thorault, senior faculty member, professor of management and marketing at GBC. The committee first reviewed President Hellens' self-evaluation and related documents as the bylaws outline. Then interviewed the president about her performance and that of the college. Then they conducted interviews with campus personnel, students, and community members interested in the college. They also held two open forums, one for students and one for classified staff at the college, and provided the results of two surveys conducted by the president on the president's performance, one by faculty and one by students. The committee then produced a report, which they submitted to me, concluded their service, and I, along with Vice Chancellor McKinnon, met with the committee to go over their findings and discuss their recommendations. President Hellens is well-regarded both at the college as well as within the community as an advocate for GBC. Her tenure as president, just coming at the end of two full academic years, has been full of significant accomplishments and successes. Comments from evaluation process reinforce that she tells the GB story very well. At the same time, there were some concerns on overall communication within the college community. The evaluation process highlights areas where more consistent and clear communications from the president be beneficial. The evaluation committee highlights the promising potential of the president as she continues to grow with the college. There's a sense that while some areas may need more of the president's focus and attention in the coming years, the college is heading in a positive direction under her leadership. Based on the faculty survey results, the committee report, and my own observations reviewing President Hellens' self-evaluation and working with her, I recommend that her contract be renewed and that the recommendations that were outlined be fully implemented. She has effectively met the evaluation metrics set by the Board of Regents. I didn't go over all those, but they are outlined in my report. She's a visible advocate for GBC and the community and fully committed to the college and student success. Under her leadership, GBC continues to increase graduation rates. It's what we're all about, increase the number of degrees and certificates, as well as providing key credentials necessary for employees across rural Nevada. Both President Helen and I together came up with two specific deliverables that we felt, based upon the evaluation, based upon where we're going, that we felt comfortable working on. The first one is communications. Obviously, when you come in and meet, you need to communicate and over-communicate. And it doesn't necessarily mean the way you're communicating is wrong. It's just there's a lot of different ways to communicate. And so we've asked that a specific group be comprised by the president with faculty and others to talk about a communication plan, both to assist in articulating where the college is going and to ensure that all those community stakeholders with GBC feels they are apprised of the issues and have multiple avenues for input. The second one is a comprehensive strategic enrollment growth. There's been no secret that GBC has focused has experienced a significant a shortfall in revenue, primarily precipitated by a decrease in the number of students and the weight of student credits during the count year, which was this past year. My staff is committed to working with President Helens, and we have been in ongoing communications about ways to, in enrollment, multiple ways. But one thing we did hear from students and faculty and others is that they really want to have a clear understanding where GBC is going and how that deficit is going to be addressed. And so part of that, an ongoing, we've had several meetings with my cabinet and with her team about identifying some specific timelines and projections and a robust and comprehensive plan to address the shortfall, and particularly about growing enrollment. And so that was the other significant recommendation. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. From the board, you have all those supporting materials for self-evaluation as well as the survey results. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
And before I go to Regent Chachuk, I want to remind the board, we're just talking about the review. The contract will be tomorrow. Regent Chachuk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I think it's incumbent upon those of us on the board to always keep in mind our prime function is to hire and fire presidents. If we get it right, the institution thrives. If we get it wrong, the institution flounders at best. The second thing I think is important for us to keep in mind is that we need to establish a best practices questionnaire that will be submitted for each of our presidents to the faculties, to the staff, to the certified employees, so that we, number one, are certain that we're doing the best job possible in the questions we ask, so that the data that we're getting back is useful to us in doing these evaluations. I think that we need to do that as soon as possible. I read through not just the summary of the reviews, but the reviews themselves, and I noted the many faculty concerns that were raised. And the question that I ask as I go through analyzing this data, is this because of the president that is coming in and making very necessary changes that are also painful? And is this a reaction to that, or is it that the president doesn't have a grasp of what the president's role is and where the institution is currently placed? And I concluded in reviewing the materials, looking at the chancellor's report and my conversations with the president, that it was the former and not the latter. So we do have work to do. We could all do better at communication. Communication, I think, is primarily listening and not talking. And
making sure that we hear what is being said. So those are my comments on this review. I support the conclusions of the Chancellor on this report, and I won't address anything having to do with what we'll talk about tomorrow. Thank you, Mr.
Perfect.
Chair.
Regent Lieberman.
I want to commend the graduation numbers and the enrollment numbers at GBC under President Helen's tenure and slightly before that. I want to commend her partnership with the community and with other presidents and other institutions within the system. My concern is that when anybody gets a survey, that they are going to use that survey to deal with issues, not just directly what is asked of them, but anything related that they want to discuss. And the survey sometimes becomes an open forum. My other question about this particular survey was there some questions like how the president deals with the chancellor or how the president deals with the Board of Regents, and faculty may not have the ability to know that, nor is it really in their sphere of influence to evaluate that. So I think we have to look at that as well as we look look to standardize our evaluation process. But I support the evaluation as outlined by the Chancellor and as reacted to by Regent Trachuk, and we will discuss the contract tomorrow.
Okay, I would entertain a motion. Okay, can you add one thing to the motion besides approval, that we would bring back in September the communication plan as well as the plan to address the deficit?
That was going to be my motion.
Second.
Perfect. Second by?
Second.
Regent McAdoo. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Motion passed. With that, congratulations and on that part, and we'll do the contract tomorrow. We are going to take a five-minute break for Regent Trachuk. And then when we come back, we're going to go to item number 14, Institutional Advisory Council, GBC, and we'll turn it over to President Helens then. Call the meeting back to order. We are actually going to go to item number 41, and then we'll go to 14. 41, Employment Contract, Chief of Staff and Special Counsel, the Board of Regents, Dean J. Gould.
Move approval.
Move for approval. Motion from Regent Trachuk.
Second
from Regent DiCarlo. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Is this a sentence or is this a contract?
Yeah, I don't know why you're thanking us, but...
It could be both, Regent Trachuk.
Okay, with that, we are going to go to item number 14, the President Helens.
I would like to thank Will Muschietti, who's a longtime Great Basin College supporter and Institutional Advisory Committee member, for taking on the role of acting chair of the GBC IAC. And Will is in Elko today, I think, right now, and he will be presenting the report.
I trust you can see me?
Not yet.
I can see and hear you, Joyce. When somebody can hear me, let me know.
We can hear you, now. Will.
We can hear you. So it's a little awkward. I was after Joyce's review there, but I was a part of that review, and I think that was well handled, well done. I'm Will Muschietti. I'm the acting interim temporary, I'm not sure what, chair of the IAC. At a meeting, the chair had resigned. Somebody needs to run the meeting. Yeah, I can do that. I didn't know this came along, but I'm happy to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today to tell you about our role, our support for Great Basin College. I know my time's limited. You're getting late in the day. So I'm going to focus on four areas. A teeny bit of housekeeping. We're going to pat ourselves on the back. We're going to focus on some significant recent and ongoing initiatives, and then nicely express some of our concerns. Why I belong to be here, but before the IACs existed, one of the founders of GBC had asked me to join the Presidential Advisory Council. That's probably 30 years ago. The Presidential Advisory Council basically was a precursor to the IACs. It's the model for the IACs. Long been a proud supporter of higher education since college was founded over 50 years ago. So first off, while we're on housekeeping, it's really important to thank the regents who found the time and the way to get Delco for the foundation dinner. Community engagement is an integral part of the success of Great Basin, has been for all 50 years. Your presence enhanced the experience for the 320-plus people who were there. Last housekeeping, I hate it when somebody reads me a report. It's almost as bad as when you read me your PowerPoint. That being said, I'm going to read this because I'm old and senile. So we're going to start by patting ourselves on the back. Great Basin Standard has a new motto, Gold Standard in the Silver State. I wasn't sure if it should be in the Silver State, for the Silver State, of the Silver State. I didn't get a vote. Gold Standard in the Silver State is what we are, who we want to be. This embraces the college's historic commitment to serving rural Nevada, creating exceptional results in delivering student success and a well-prepared workforce. Some examples of our gold standard would be being the number one ranked nursing program in the state, having 100% nursing graduation employment rates, and aside, two new grant-funded nursing programs have just come online in Winnemucca and Pahrump. We've received numerous online awards, including, God, this is going to be embarrassing, Most Affordable College in Nevada, Best Online Associate's Degree in Human Services, Early Childhood, Education, Computer Programming, Accounting, Medical Billing, Coding, Survey, and Human Services. Now, I don't know who we were competing with, but that's a pretty nice list. We also Best Online Bachelor in Business Management, Information Technology, English, Data Sciences. Recently, at this last graduation, GBC awarded its first Bachelor in Science in Biological Sciences degree to 7 women. This degree program provides the opportunity for rural Nevada students to take the upper division level courses that they're going to need as offerings and prerequisites to get into a medical school, a dental school, or many other health programs. 4 of these grads are taking the MCATs this summer, hoping they're coming back to practice medicine in rural Nevada. I'm going to need them. So let's talk for a wee bit about recent and ongoing initiatives. In the fall of 2018, GBC initiated a Bachelor's of Applied Science in Human Services launched in Pahrump, offering behavioral health. I didn't do very good with behavioral. Let me try that again. Offering behavioral health, substance abuse, and addictions medicine. This program trains students to work in these helping fields and applies evidence-based behavioral health interventions and processes that provide a positive impact on the lives of individuals, families, and communities. One of our highlighted ongoing programs, the Maintenance Training Cooperative Scholarship Program. It's an industry-supported scholarship signing in 5 technical programs supported by Barrick, the money of Barrick, Newmont, Kinross, Sandvik, Florida Canyon, Komatsu, SSR, Brown Mountain, and anybody else I missed. This coming year, 79 CET students will receive a $5,000 per year scholarship and a paid paid internship to GBC while being there. These two both are about $400,000 contributions each, like an $800,000 contribution to this MTC program. Since that program started probably 25 years ago, we're close to $20 million of investment from these programs. The rural technical programs continue to thrive. In 2019 at White Pine High School, the Diesel Technology Program was started. 13 students. I think there were more students than there were spaces. That was WINN funding, an amount of $482,000, I believe. I might have numbers wrong, but I'm not here to talk numbers. We're still in the patting ourselves on the back. electrical systems technology program has been initiated both Winnemucca and Ely. This fall, a manufacturing machining program will kick off in Pahrump. Based on early indications, it's going to be well oversubscribed. We got way more people who want to take this class than we can service. This spring, a CDL, Commercial Driver's License Program, was initiated at the request of industry via WIN funding, and an industry consortium has been formed to continue the funding of this program past when the window wins. Hybrid and electrical instrumentation classes, where we take your employees, get them further up to speed, on go with Round Mountain, Barrick, Gulp, Kinross, Turlock, Turquoise Ridge, and many others. Importantly, the administration is engaged in collaborations, which I think are really important to our continued success. I know we share many services with Western Nevada and UNR. Our leadership of UNR GBC met last year and discussed many ideas about, hey, where can we share services? Finance, administration, academic affairs, student affairs. Do we really need three people here and two people there, or should two people be doing it all? A lot of those ideas have already come to fruition, and I suspect there's many more down the road. One of the most important things, I think Jake Rivera, I don't know if you've all met Jake Rivera, one of our newer members, is really gearing up for enrollment management transition. We're embarking on a program to transition from a structural and tactical to a student-centered enrollment strategy that leads to optimized enrollment rather than historical precedents. As we focus on growing enrollments, leadership has identified and begun to implement strategic enrollment strategies focusing on how to enroll, attract, retain, and graduate students. Well, take the data from that that will support building strategic enrollments. These strategies will assist GBC to predict enrollments and determine how to best accommodate the growth and how to improve the education of our spirit students. GBC's focus, with emphasis on continued improvement and new collaborations by our leadership and supported by the GBC IAC, will continue to be on improving student success and the quality of the student experience, as well as improving the planning process to reduce the instability in enrollment growth through more measured growth strategies. So we're almost done. We're down to concerns. It's really hard for me. I got dogs in this fight. I'd like to be a dink here and go, God, we could use a few bucks. But that's not what I wrote. Our most relevant threats to student success and program quality have been the reduction of resources necessary to provide student support, services, adequate facility, and state-of-the-art classroom facility. My understanding that today we face an approximate $1.6 billion deficit. Last year, my understanding is our budget was given a task of filling a seven-figure shortfall in a matter of days. Not weeks, days. Hey, by the way, Sonia, we're a million short. That's unacceptable. After a decade of funding reduction that led GBC to losing a third of its workforce, there's not much left to cut. In the light of that losing a third of the workforce, you'll note, I think you heard in Joyce's remarks there, or the remarks of Joyce, the number of degrees and certificates has continued to go up. The college has a growth strategy of this combination of improving current practice, adding best-in-practice processes, new collaboration, shared services, as well as implementing new programs and nixing the ones that have come to the end of the life cycle. More importantly, I and the IAC understand there's no magic wand to get the college out of this deficit. It's going to have to be a multi-tiered approach that includes a growth strategy of new academic and technical courses programs geared to the workforce we serve, community engagement meetings identified five task forces, and this isn't written, so it might not come out right, identified what's the community need and want at GBC. Athletics was one of the most highly recommended things. So GBC right now is in the process of trying on a limited basis to join a conference, have a volleyball team. We think that can bring us a lot of kids who'd be go somewhere else to play. We depend on a balanced mix of state appropriations, tuition, and foundation support, none of which are likely to see significant increases in the foreseeable future. This is all the more reason for me and our IAC to be the champion for issues such as, I've got emphasis right here, so pay attention, strongly supporting a review of the current funding formula and its real impact on our community colleges, particularly rural Nevada. The course funding, course weighting process is riddled with oddities. Fortunately, we have enough CTE classes. It's not onerous to GBC, but there is some weird stuff in that weighting process. More of relevance is the count year process. We get zero for this year and 100% for next year and zero for the other. We should close the doors for a year. Gee whiz. What, I'm not sure I remember what was wrong with the three-year moving average, and let us know a couple years ahead of time what the budget might be, as opposed to, here's count year, by the way, you're... At any rate, I would hope to rely on the regents to engage in a current rate... Let me try that sentence once more. I would hope to rely on the regents to engage in a current and regular funding formula review as well. Working together, we can make the gold standard in the Silver State much more sustainable, not only for rural Nevada, but all of Nevada. Before I closed, I plan to lament a lack of state funding for participation in the proposed health sciences building in Winnemucca and continued deferral of our funding for the, how to nicely say this, decades-old quest for some rehab at the welding lab. While much remains to be done, we are very appreciative of our legislatures, NCHI, anybody else who is involved, for never giving up, and grateful that in that last-minute pile of pork that was handed out, we actually have some planning dollars for that. Some real dollars to help with Winnemucca building the health science or to actually rehab the welding facilities would be a benefit, but we're glad for what we have. That being said, I'm privileged and honored to serve. Hopefully there's not questions. Thank you.
Does the board have any questions?
Oh, man.
No, you can stay on.
God.
No questions allowed. I'm interim.
Well, thank you so much for a very entertaining report. We appreciate it. And thanks for your service. With that, With that, we are going to go to item number 28, Southern Nevada Police Consolidation. Vice Chairman Silva Kenning and Commander Garcia.
Chair Page, if I could say some just introductory remarks. As you know, the board has approved the consolidation of CSN and UNLV police departments into a single Nevada command structure at the October 2018 meeting of the Board of Regents. The vote came after thorough review, which began in late 2007 by a group of current and former higher education chiefs of police associated with ICLEA. Today, we are delighted to bring to you this update on the work underway that ultimately joined the two departments into a single unit and serves CSN, DRI, Nevada State College, and UNLV with a high level of service. Throughout our work exploring these important issues, the safety of students, faculty, and staff has remained our highest priority. Any potential cost savings, while important, can in no way jeopardize the safety of our institutions. It is our hope that through this lens, we'll be able to increase the level of service and safety for all our institutions. We anticipate bringing back a full implementation plan to the board for your approval later this year once it's developed. I'd like to invite Vice Chancellor McKinnon and Southern Command Director Adam Garcia to provide an overview of the work underway.
Just, did you leave it open-ended enough later this year? Thanks, guys. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through you to the members, Nate McKinnon for the record. It's a pleasure to be here with you and provide you an update on the Southern Police consolidation effort that's underway. As an introduction to this item, particularly for newer members of the board, the consolidation of police and public safety operations at Southern Nevada NC institutions has been discussed for quite some time. More recently, in September of 2017, the board instructed the chancellor to bring in outside expertise to analyze the feasibility and possible models to achieve police consolidation in Southern Nevada. It should be noted that this vote followed the successful consolidation of two police departments into one in Northern Nevada. Those were Truckee Meadows Community College and University of Nevada Reno Police Departments. That consolidation was completed in 2016. At that time, NC engaged with the International Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators, or IACLEA, as the Chancellor mentioned. The team from IACLEA was comprised of well-respected current and retired administrators that went and spent a full week here in Nevada and developed a comprehensive report on steps to move forward. The four Southern Nevada institutions were previously serviced by two separate police departments, the UNLV Police Department, which provided services to UNLV, DRI, and Nevada State College, and the CSN Police Department, which provided services to the three CSN campuses. Last fall, at the October 2019 Board of Regents meeting, the board heard a presentation from IACLEA with their report and formally approved the consolidation of the CSN and UNLV police departments, along with an MOU for the institutions to begin the process of consolidation. As was presented to the board at that meeting, step one for the Southern Nevada institutions was to identify a new leader for the Southern Command who would be tasked with bringing the different organizations into a single entity. After a national search by a broad-based committee, the presidents of the Southern institutions unanimously appointed Adam Garcia as the new director of Southern Command. Mr. Garcia is no stranger to most of you, as he spent the prior 18 years here at the University of Nevada, Reno as police chief and also oversaw the successful implementation of the consolidation of the Northern Police Departments. Director Garcia began his tenure in Southern Nevada in February of this year, and as you'll hear in a moment, has clearly hit the ground running. Immediately after his arrival, I convened the first meeting of the Southern Police Advisory Group, which consists of Presidents Averett, Miana, Patterson, and Zaragoza, along with their respective budget officers. This group will continue to meet as the implementation plan is being fully developed and then in an ongoing fashion beyond that to help with guide the overall work of the newly consolidated police department. As the Chancellor said, today we're here to provide you an update on the work underway towards full implementation. And with that, I would like to introduce Adam Garcia, Director of University Police Services, Southern Command.
Thank you. When the Chief's coming up, I just want to make a comment. I think... Thank you to the Northern University presidents, right, and DRI and TMCC, because that's where the resistance was to move forward. And the same thing for the Southern presidents. You change a couple of presidents and all of a sudden it becomes a hot topic. And as well as you, Chief, appreciate your efforts both up here as well as what you've done in Southern Nevada. So,
thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman and board members. It has been stated the purpose of this is an update to give you regarding the status of police services consolidation in Southern Nevada. But before I get into the presentation, I wanted to thank each of the four presidents who I currently serve. I could not ask for a better group of bosses. The collegial relationships that we have built is amazing. Their support is appropriate to what we're attempting to accomplish, as well as the four campuses. I've met with literally hundreds of individuals, groups, faculty, staff, student government leaders. Those that I've met over the last 3.5 months that I've been there have been highly supportive of this process and have asked many, many times how they can best accommodate the needs that we have to make this a success. So before I get to the actual meat of the report, I wanted to provide you with the vision that we have established within police services. And the mantra in Southern Nevada is that we live in a world-class community. Millions of people want to go there every year. They want to be part of this community there. We, police services, serve four exceptional and world-class institutions. And our goal overall is to transform police services into a world-class department. As we move forward in the next 3 to 5 years, my goal is that when other institutional law enforcement agencies look at police services in Southern Nevada, they're going to say, we want to be like them. We will become the model for the rest of the nation. This vision is embodied in our vision statement at police services. It's embodied in our mission statement. It's embodied in our value statement, as well as our department slogan. Over the last 3.5 months that I've been with police services, we have had a number of major accomplishments. My thanks to President Miana, who has been wholly supportive of a $5.2 million law enforcement complex that was built on campus, the funding of a $1.2 million state-of-the-art communication system, which we are currently in the process of building. We have introduced body-worn cameras department-wide to all 80 officers in the consolidated department. We are in the process of standardizing uniforms, vehicles, equipment, policies and procedures, and establish an office of clery compliance that will ensure that we are compliant with Department of Education regulations as it pertains to clery. We have accomplished much of what we've done through the establishment of committee. I am seeking the input of all members of the department, both the prior CSN Police Department and UNLV Police Department, and they are covering a number of topics, including training, policies, vehicles, equipment. Across the board, I wanted to seek input from the department that I serve so that they can provide me with what the needs are of the department. This week, I established a homeless community outreach unit within police services. The individual assigned to this area will work closely with Metro and other law enforcement agencies in the county, our campus and community partners, to address the homeless issue and its impact on our campuses. The unit is meant to identify our homeless students, faculty, and staff, those who are at risk, to ensure that our homeless population on our campuses are treated with dignity and respect, to channel our homeless population to the available resources within the community, to provide department training, and lastly, to take enforcement action if all other processes fail. Our intent is to balance the need of those who are seeking resources with our obligation to maintain a safe, secure, and welcoming environment for all of the people that we serve. In the last 3.5 months, we have applied for approximately $500,000 in grant funding. In the last 3.5 months since I became the director, we have received $59,000 for radios, $41,000 for traffic safety and education, $136,000 for metal detectors that will be used at Thomas and Mack and other special event venues throughout the four campuses. We have partnered with the University of Nevada, Reno Police Services, and my thanks to Chief Renwick, to buy multiple live scan machines through a grant process of $117,000 and applied for another $12,000 for bulletproof vests for our officers. What we've done in essence in Southern Nevada is obviously Vice Chancellor McKinnon said, I report to all four presidents at this time, and divided our patrol areas into a central division, which is made up of UNLV and DRI, the largest footprint, that area where there's the greatest concentration of people in special events, and a regional division that includes CSN, Nevada State College, and the Medical District. Those divisions, as you can see here on the map with the appropriate locations, are further divided into sectors, patrol sectors, which will allow for a timely response as well as an appropriate level of visibility. We are currently looking at combining similar and duplicative services beyond what we've already done, including and most importantly the security contracts that the three institutions have with security services. We intend on terminating the Clark County School District dispatch contract and combining it into one dispatch center, including the monitoring stations for video surveillance. All of these will be combined into the new state-of-the-art dispatch center. Moving forward, our intent is to have the dispatch center up and running by October of 2019. The standardization of our policies and procedures across the department should be done within the next 30 days. We intend on implementing enhanced training and exercise programs for patrol and emergency management. I have met extensively with Metro PD Henderson in North Las Vegas. They're on board. They see us as partners, and we see them as partners, so we're going to work together at ensuring that this takes place. We are working on coordination of emergency management programs across the board, and a side note to that, we have worked with the Department of Homeland Security. They will be providing a multi-asset system assessment process to help us identify potential areas on the four campuses that provide for that need shoring up as it relates to their security initiatives. We're working with them now. We intend on having this completed with UNLV by the end of the summer, then working with CSN, Nevada State College, and DRI in completing their assessments as well. The intent is that we will continue the implementation process that this board directed the four institutions to complete. We will have an implementation plan that will be presented to the board for approval in December. And if approved, we intend on moving forward with full implementation in early 2020.
Up for any questions or comments?
Regent DiCarlo.
I just want to say, wow, what you've accomplished in 3.5 months is remarkable, and I thank you. It just shows you that leadership starts at the top, and you are the right guy for this job. And what are you going to do when this is all done?
Retire.
5-7 years.
Good point, yeah. Hey, Regent Lieberman.
Excellent example of the collaboration between this board and our institutions system-wide. If we had had this discussion during the first page administration, if you will, it would have been a much different dialogue. It was a much different dialogue, and I thank all the parties for coming together and really making this work what will be soon statewide. So thank you.
Thank you. Oh, President Miana.
Marta Miana, for the record, I just want to say that at UNLV, we really could not be more pleased with Chief Garcia and the progress of the consolidation. From the increasing professionalization of the entire operation, which is so important, to the successful grant proposals, to the collaborative nature of the consolidation process, it really has been a breath of fresh air, and all indications are that the full implementation of the consolidation will be completed as scheduled for January 2020, and we couldn't be happier about this process.
President Z.
Yeah, we'd simply like to echo the sentiments that President Miana has expressed and also commend the communication systems, not only with the presidents, but also with our business officers. And then getting the word out into the campus has been amazing. So, again, I want to recognize the great leadership that Director Garcia brings to this effort.
Absolutely. Hey, Chief, also said that's a great patch.
Thank you.
Very well done. I have hundreds and hundreds of first respond, the law enforcement, fire patches, and that one looks really cool. So,
and that patch was created by the department and submitted to me for approval, so it wasn't my thinking. I'll have to give them the credit.
And great job on the grants, because we had asked at a previous meeting prior to your arrival of how many grants they had, and the answer was zero. So it's not that they're not out there, but we appreciate you being aggressive and going for them. Regent Carlo? No. Oh, Regent Trajan.
I just think it's, first of all, Chief, thank you very much. But I think it's appropriate, especially for the new members of the board, to have an appreciation of why we're able to have this discussion today. This has been the brainchild and the baby of Kevin Page, and he was, as he can be, relentless in pursuing it. And We all thank you for raising this issue with us and being tireless in your advocacy for the issue.
Thank you. With that, we're going to go to Regent Carter for disclosure.
Is this in relationship to item 24?
Oh, I'm sorry. We're not going to go to Regent Carter. Okay, seeing that, thanks for the update. Look forward to the update in December.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, we are going to go to item number 24, health insurance fees. Now we're going to go to Regent Carter.
Okay. According to Nevada Commission on Ethics Opinion Number 19-016A, I'm disclosing that I was previously a student in the Gaming Innovation course at UNLV, where I developed a casino game. And if the casino game is marketed and sold, I'm required to pay remuneration to UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course were required to sign. I receive no remuneration from UNLV. I am disclosing this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A as recommended by the Nevada Ethics Commission. As this agenda item will not affect my significant pecuniary interests associated with UNLV's gaming innovation course and its subject contracts, associated policy changes, contract interpretation, collection matters, or litigation issues in accordance with NRS Chapter 281A, I will be voting on this agenda item.
That's a mouthful. Okay. With that, we go to CFO Klinger.
Thank you, Chair Page and Regents. Before you today is a revision to the procedures and guidelines manual for student health insurance rates for academic year 2019-20. This is an item that comes to you every June. So there are three things that we're asking for: approval of the insurance rates. Secondly, we're asking you to allow the addition of undergraduate nursing students at UNLV. And lastly, UNLV is asking for an increase in their student health fee center to $82.50 for academic year 2019-20 and to $93 for 2021. This recommendation has been reviewed by the insurance committees, which does include student representatives.
We have a motion. Yes, Regent Hayes.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I'm going to be abstaining on this item as I work for a health insurance company, United Healthcare, and so I will not be deliberating or voting on this item.
Okay. We have a motion from Regent Trachuk, a second from Regent Lieberman.
Yes.
Any further discussion? Seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? We have the one abstention. Okay, we are going to go to item number 25. Handbook and Procedures, Guidelines, Manual Revisions, Distinguished Nevadan, Regent Emeritus, and Honorary Degree Criteria. General Counsel Reynolds.
Good afternoon, Board of Regents. I believe this matter is straightforward. It adds the prohibition of someone who is running as a candidate for public office to be ineligible to receive an honorary degree, the Regent Emeritus status, or the Distinguished Nevadan Award, and corresponding codifications of those in the Handbook and Procedures and Guidelines Manual.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Would it be appropriate and possible to reopen whether or not we even have a category of Regent Emeritus at this time?
No. Thank you.
Not agenda. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Regent Hayes.
Yeah, if we could just have General Counsel Reynolds discuss on the record how running for office is defined.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. When I thought of making these changes, we could have been very prescriptive and qualified it, Regent Hayes, as something of filing formally with the Secretary of State or with the County Registrar. I did intend, though, to leave it a little bit open-ended as running as a candidate. These are honorary awards or recognitions from the Board of Regents, and when someone's running either by word of mouth or a formally declared, and it's known by a regent, this prohibition would apply. I hope that answers your question, Regent Hayes.
It does. I mean, it's not completely definitive, but as we all know, that we ran for office and your campaign starts months and some of these other offices years in advance. So it's just tough to define, and I was wondering if you had a better way of doing it, but it sounds like that's the best we're going to get. So thank you for thank you.
Okay. Motion for approval. Regent DeBrava. Second by
Second.
Regent Lieberman. All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. With that, I think we ran out.
If you want to pull something else, you could.
Okay. Just want to just get a pulse from the board. We're pulling items from tomorrow. Do you want us to continue? And okay. Is Joe Sunberry here?
Would you be willing to do this?
Okay. For SCS, we're going to item 29. So if there's anything that relates to that, I don't know.
Okay, so item number 29, Internal Audit Incident Management. Mr. Sunberry, welcome.
Thanks, Chair Page. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, Joe Sunberry, Chief Internal Auditor at ENCHI. This will be an extremely brief update on our establishment of a mechanism for incident management. I won't read the briefing memo line by line, but did want to point out for the newer regents some of the background behind my role, and specifically some of the recent salient changes to the Internal Audit Charter. So direction from the board at their December 2018 special meeting resulted in changes to Internal Audit's administrative structure. And Internal Audit's charter was amended to include that my role, Chief Internal Auditor, serves as a clearinghouse for matters requiring investigatory activity and shall establish a mechanism for incident management. So it's been a few months. So what's been done on this front? In the first quarter of 2019, calendar 19, that is, the focus was establishment of processes. As regents well know, when concerns are reported, there are any number of avenues where you can direct these concerns. But in terms of process, it's been historically ad hoc. So in real time, we were able to determine and establish a way to formalize the intake process. And that is how to best triage items, when to direct them to proper subject matter experts, or when to add reviews to my own internal audit team schedule. Part of formalizing that process included establishing what I'll refer to as a hotline, which we successfully accomplished here in the second quarter of calendar 2019. When I say hotline, as noted in the briefing memo, this includes a 1-800 number, as well as an online portal established through Navex Global and their EthicsPoint platform. The online portal is linked to ENCHI's home webpage, just below your 13 beautiful pictures. So what exactly is that? From the perspective of the user, any student or employee with a concern can simply click a button and be directed to a page giving them many options, what category of concern they may have, if they'd wish to remain anonymous, etc. And it's important to point out, I included some of our awareness materials in today's update, specifically the picture of the owl in the night sky. We really wanted to drive home the point that this is open 24/7. And as a side note, I've had great conversations with folks in the Chancellor's office about internal and external communication possibilities, perhaps getting something out there on social media, and that's really what the next step will be in this formal rollout. So literally, a person could call this number New Year's Eve, stroke of midnight, and they can talk to a live person. So those reports, whether submitted via phone or online, are summarized and sent to the administrators of the line. So from the perspective of the administrator, in this case me, the system is very user-friendly, allows me to quickly determine next steps, and again, that may be refer to a subject matter expert on a particular campus and then monitor the progress, or maybe to take an item as an internal audit project via either an immediate project or add it to a future audit plan, or some kind of collaboration or coordinated effort. But more than that, it starts tracking and allows us to gain a snapshot of where things stand at a given point. It helps us monitor status. The experience so far has been very positive. It's still very early, but as time goes on and trends develop, I can certainly share them. And just for the record, I've seen multiple examples in the last few months where the board's efforts and direction on this front have really created a proactive, positive, collaborative environment and really good conversations. In the terms of the role itself, my role specifically, I feel it's still developing. I think that development has been expedited through utilization of established relationships and laying the foundations for new ones. I've appreciated the input along the way of Dean Gould, Joe Reynolds, and countless personnel from the institutions who not only tolerated my presence, but welcomed me on their campuses. So as we continue, I welcome your thoughts on how I can improve this role. And I hope to meet with each of you individually in the next fiscal year so we can shape expectations for future updates. Thanks.
Mr. Sunbury, thanks for all your efforts. You really have taken the ball and run with this. In regards to social media, you might want to see what the Chancellor, he could probably tweet it. He tweets a lot, and he'll run with it right now if you want. Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering on the back end, how do you keep track of this? Is there like some type of database that's maintained, and how do you keep track of the complaints and like tick marks of how they're moving forward?
Yes, excellent question. And that's one of the things that this incident management system specializes in. It's so in addition to the hotline and the web intake portal, we also have a database. And so as items come in, we can when a call comes in or when somebody enters something through the online portal, it automatically gets put into that database. If somebody wants to send something via U.S. mail and send it on a postcard and voice their concern, I can take that and still enter it into this database so we can take advantage of that tracking. So, thanks.
Thank you. Regent Cavallo, and then Regent DeCall.
Is this meant to be a central intake type of system, or is this in addition to each institution's intake?
That's an excellent question. My take on this, it's certainly not meant to replace or supersede anything that the institutions have. We I think part of this process has made me realize just how many wonderful avenues we have at our institutions, and we want to make sure that students are aware of those. This is meant to complement that. This is meant to supplement that. And in my brief experiences with the institutions that I've worked with so far, it's really been a great coordinated effort, and it's kind of increased that monitoring mechanism.
Thanks. We're going to go to Regent DeCarlo, then Regent Hayes.
Thank you, Chair Page. I was just wondering what the cost of this is to have. Is it NAVIX Global?
Yes, no.
And whose budget does that come out of? Enchi's?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. So from a cost perspective, the base cost of this is $8,750 for the year. There are some one-time costs for setup and awareness materials that take year one cost will be around $12,000. But that's just for the first year. And again, that gets us the database where we track these items, the phone hotline, the web intake, the picture with the owl on it. In terms of the budget, I believe this year it came out of internal audit's operating budget. I don't know if that'll always be the case, but if it is, that's okay, because I think that's part of this new role that I'm taking on. Thanks.
We got Regent Hayes.
Mr. Sunbury, did you say that the link is on the Regent bio page?
On the front page. He was asking where the link was.
Oh, yes. So
I thought he had said it was below our pictures. I'm sorry.
Yes, just on the front page, nc.nevada.edu, when you scroll down a little bit, you'll see the 13 pictures, and it's just below there.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure it was in a very prominent place so it's easy for people to find. Thank you.
Thanks. Is somebody, any idea of numbers of usage?
Sure. Well, we actually, because this hotline rolled out relatively recently, we just received our first actual call to it, less than a week ago. But in this new role for the calendar year, in the second quarter, we've had 7 items come in, via various mechanisms. In the first quarter, that number was 8 items. So that's about the volume that we're dealing with. And then of those items, roughly half of them were referred to a subject matter expert on campus, and then I keep in touch with that subject matter expert and we monitor. And then roughly half of them were in some way, shape, or form taken on by internal audit via quick review or via planning for submission on next year's audit plan.
Thank you. Okay.
With that, we are going to recess for the day.